Call the Environment Policy Oversight Committee for February 11th to order. First thing on the agenda, we do need to approve the minutes from February 9th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson moves the minutes of February 9th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Minutes are approved. Well, today we are going to be doing an informational hearing dealing with the Red River Valley flooding situation. There's going to be a lot of interesting testimony today. We do have the Army Corps of Engineers here. We also have folks from the Red River Basin Commission, some people from the Red River Valley who have experienced the devastating effects of the flood that occurred last year. So I would like to first start with Mr. John Finney, who is the chair of the Red River Watershed Management Board, and also Joe River, Watershed District Manager. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Finney. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Yes, my name is John. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Thank you. My name is John Finney. I'm a small grain and sugar beet farmer from Kitson County, Minnesota. In that capacity, I'm also the president of the Red River Watershed Management Board, and if you'd like me to continue, I could.
Yes.
We are a joint powers board that was created by legislative action in 1976 to address the flooding problems on the Minnesota side of the Red River. In that capacity, we have been very proactive in our approach to flood damage reduction. We have built and maintained several detention structures in the tributaries upstream of the Red River in order to reduce the damages caused by flooding downstream. As you can well imagine, this is a very lengthy and expensive process. In the mid-1990s, the Red Board had come to an impasse as the ability to receive permits to construct projects was virtually impossible. At that time, the Minnesota legislature ordered that there be a negotiated agreement formed between the Red River Watershed Management Board, state and federal agencies, and the environmental community in order to break this long-standing gridlock. In 1998, a mediated settlement was reached, and as a result of that action, the Flood Damage Reduction Work Group was formed to oversee the implementation of projects in the Red River Basin. My main objective in addressing your committee today, Mr. Chairman, is to encourage your continued support for our endeavors. These efforts include not only detention, but natural resource enhancement, the Farmstead Ring Dike Program, and various technical endeavors which enable us to better determine the ability of our projects to have the greatest impact for the money spent. As a result of the spring flooding in 2009 and the talk of a diversion around the Moorhead-Fargo area, the Red Board is faced with a new set of circumstances. Our mediated agreement states that we will not pass on any additional flood problems downstream resulting from actions upstream in the watershed. Recent Corps of Engineers report indicates that if a diversion is built around Metro Moorhead, there will be a significant flow increases downstream. This is an issue that needs to be addressed before the project such as this can move forward. Some of these problems can be rectified rather easily, such as increased support for our Farmstead Ring Dike Program. After the 2009 flood event, we had several requests for new ring dikes that far exceeded the ability to finance them in a timely manner. The increase in downstream flows is, however, a much more serious matter. It'll take a joint effort by state, federal authorities, as well as local units of government, such as the Red Board, to mitigate these damages. With the advances in technology, such as the recently completed LIDAR mapping project and the development of new flow models for the basin, it is very possible that these problems can be rectified. The key, however, is the financial support of the state and federal government. Without this cooperation, many of these endeavors will not be completed and damages from flooding will continue to increase. Thank you very much for your consideration. If there's any questions, I'll attempt to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Finney. Maybe we'll have Mr. Deal, Jerome Deal, if you would like to state your name and position for the record and testify, and then we'll have questions.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Jerome Deal, Boise Sioux Watershed, but I'm a co-chair of the Flood Damage Reduction Work Group. And this is a group that was founded after the mediation agreement, and part of it, actually the mediation agreement, I was the beginning of it, the beginning six. I know when they say history, I start to worry about it, whether I'm getting outdated or not. But the reduction work group has made the projects with natural resource enhancements and flood damage reduction. We were able to marry the two things together. We have interdisciplinary teams in each watershed that work on it, so by the time a project hits the ground, it has the environmental input, the flood input, and the mediation work group has kind of a oversight role to the watersheds, just advisory to keep them on track. Because of this mediation, that the agreement was signed and what has worked with the environmental groups, these projects have moved forward with total support. I mean, we haven't had to fight any in the legislature. We come down with support. In fact, I think you could lower the DNR's legal defense budget. Those lawsuits aren't happening anymore out of the Red River Valley like they were. So, and we're proud that the Red River Valley area, the Flood Damage Reduction Work Group, has been able to do this and has been able to get landowners, environmentalists, and hydrology all together on the same page. And we're at a point where we can move forward at a fast pace. So I support that, and I think it was a wise move by the legislature, very wise, to bring it to this position. So I think you have to pat yourself on the back for having the oversight to see that. So with that.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Deal and Mr. Finney. And I think you also deserve a pat on the back for the work that you've been doing in the mediation process and putting together a comprehensive plan for the Red River watershed. That's what we need, I believe. And it's obvious that you feel that retention is an important part of the overall goal here and solution to the problems that we're facing in the Red. Are there any questions at all for Mr. Finney and Mr. Deal? Representative Hansen. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Finney or Mr. Deal, you mentioned about the need for continued state support, and we all just heard today from the governor about shortfalls this year and shortfalls in the future. And so as a watershed district, you have levy authority. Could you, either of you, maybe talk about the local dollars that are put into ring dikes or put into the agreements that could or do match any state bonding dollars, whether we've done ring dikes in the past or some of the other retention projects? What is there from the local level in terms of the finances that goes with any investment we make at the state level?
Mr. Finney.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, in answer to that, the ring dike program is funded at a 50% rate, 50% state share, and 50% local share. We've been augmenting the local share with the 25% share from our funds gathered from the Red River Watershed Management Board. But other than that, yes, it's 50-50.
And Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen, and let's hope that this year isn't a repeat of last year, but it looks like it may be, huh? Just a quick question. Whatever you do obviously affects, you mentioned, downstream and also North Dakota. Do you work in conjunction with them, or how do you handle that, being this is on the border?
Mr. Finney.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson. We have, through the cooperation in the last couple of years, had more to do with the North Dakota people than we've ever had before with our common problems associated around the Fargo-Moorhead flooding. This has been partially brought together by the Red River Basin Commission, of which you will hear from later on today in these hearings. We have been talking about, we are now on the legislated funding for the Fargo-Moorhead or the Red River Valley Flood Damage Reduction Plan. Have joint boards together for our technical and advisory committee. So it's an ongoing effort.
Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Mr. Finney and Mr. Deal. Next we will have, Representative Saylor does have a question.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question was, there was talk about what is your role with North Dakota, but also I'm just wondering, how about with some of the Canadian downstream, some of those programs, what do you have to say about what we're doing with them, and how they're working together with the Red Board and others?
Mr. Finney.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Saylor, we do have, I could tell you a cute story that most nights I sleep with a Canadian, so that maybe is kind of helps some. But we have a couple of efforts through our red board in that we started the through the also with the Basin Commission and the Rosa River Watershed District, as we have a Rosa River International Watershed Board, of which uses both the people from the RM of Montcalm and Franklin in Manitoba and the Rosa River Watershed District. And we all have the authority to spend money in Manitoba. However, that just hasn't seemed to have come up right now. But I would say, as far as the international thing, the Rosa River International Water Board is our first endeavor in something like that.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, again, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we have Mr. Mike Carroll.
What am I supposed to say, Henry?
Well, did you want Mr. Van Offlin to to speak? If you want to, yeah. Welcome, Mr. Van Offlin, and if you could go ahead, state your name and position for the tape.
I'm delighted to be here. My name is Mike Carroll. I'm the Northwest Regional Director for DNR out of Bemidji. I just came from the interviews for the new fishery section chief. So, three excellent candidates. I'm delighted to be here. I am co-chair now with Mr. Deal and the Flood Damage Reduction Working Group. And we in the DNR are very, very, very supportive and working very hard under the mediation agreement to get the natural resource elements in the Flood Damage Reduction Working Group project. So, delighted to be here. Mr. Lacusmo is here. If I misstep, I'm new. Mr. Swenson, who had that position, retired last week, so I'm learning as we go along. But we are here again. It's been excellent. The mediation agreement has saved us, as my co-chair said, legislative problems, and we are working. We have members on all the teams working with the watershed districts related to, as you have seen on tour, to deal with natural resource values on the flood damage reduction projects. So with that, I'll slow down and let Mr. Van Offlin speak.
Mr. Van Off.
Thanks for the opportunity today to speak to you, representatives. I'm just going to start off and go through the slides in the packet.
And maybe, Mr. Van Offlin, if you could just state your position as well.
I'm Henry Van Offlin. I work for Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I'm the natural resource scientist for them. I live in Detroit Lakes and have been working on Red River Basin projects for over 10 years. We've already, Jerome and has covered some of this. We're talking about this mediation agreement that's been in existence since 1998. A number of organizations are involved, and they've already covered these challenges and opportunities. This all dates back to an EIS and fighting and feuding over water and water projects and permits. So the legislature decided in prior to 1998 to do this mediated agreement. It was signed by 20 parties. It really outlines, and this is what we've been working on the past 10 years, a watershed-based approach to flood damage reduction and natural resource enhancement. And it recommended a problem-based approach to developing solutions. In the prior to mediation, there were lots of watershed districts and other organizations developing projects to deal with problems, and then they would go to the permitting agencies with their projects after having spent tens of thousands of dollars in project development and were not able to get permits. Now we're all at the table on a watershed basis trying to work on problems and develop projects that will solve the problems and also get permits and funding. And, you know, there's many people in this room that sit on project teams throughout the Red River Basin. These are all the folks that signed the mediation agreement. Another part of the mediation agreement was we need to develop comprehensive plans for all the watershed districts. And we are just about completed with those after 9 years. Those are plans that have sections on flood damage reduction. They also have sections in the watershed plans on natural resource enhancement. So they're comprehensive plans that look quite good. And you'll hear about some of these, and there's some of this in your packet. There's numerous permitted, funded, and completed projects in all watersheds. And there are other projects that are in the queue ready to move forward. This basically shows the five general types of projects. There's impoundments that go on channel that store or detain water. There's projects that have been built that store water adjacent to channels, not directly on them. We have, depending on the project type, there can be quite a bit of upland and wetland restoration and enhancement, riparian corridor and buffer restoration enhancement, and river rehabilitation, and working closely with DNR on dam removal projects and modifications. This is just a map of some of the projects spread throughout the Red River Basin that are impoundments in red and stream rehabilitation projects in blue. Most of these have been developed in the last 10 years. Some of these are in the queue right now, ready to move forward. And we'll give some more examples of those projects. This is one of the off-channel type impoundments that is on the landscape now. And then this is sort of your typical river, or this in this case was a ditch restoration, where CRP and RIM were used to establish a riparian corridor here. This formerly had been a ditch, and now it's a sinuous channel. So it's flood damage reduction from getting really at-risk lands into a different land use. The first project, and I'm just going to go over three projects quickly here that have been developed by two different watershed districts. This is Project 60 in the Red Lake watershed. What you've got there is an outline of the sub-watershed. I'll just outline it for you. This is right near East Grand Forks. This project has a number of components. On the upper part of the watershed, there's a series of impoundments that have been proposed and also now constructed. There's some channel restoration below each of these. And then the last piece is way over here by the Red River, a reconnection of almost 7 miles of stream back to the Red River. So I just covered these. This is pretty much the components. That's the type of impoundment that's on the landscape now, where the lay of the land is such that you can build dikes around three sides, essentially, of this area and direct water into it. On one side, it's probably 4 feet tall. On the downhill side, it's, say, 18 feet tall. That's an impoundment in use. The last piece of Project 60 is the Grand Marais Creek outlet. This is Grand Marais Creek. This is the Red River. I don't know if you can see that very well, hopefully. About 50 years ago, a ditch comes in here and went straight to the Red River, cutting off 7 miles of stream channel. As part of this overall project in this sub-watershed, the watershed district has gone in and acquired and worked with landowners to acquire 470 acres in this stream corridor, and is now waiting to finish the project, which is to build a diversion structure and divert water into this former channel. And also to this area C is right now a pretty good or a bad gully with a lot of erosion. So this project is to finalize, now that the land is acquired, to finish this project, get water put back in these 7 miles of channel, and to fix this area C. and that's just the features of the Grand Marais project. It's all the way through the engineering phases, and an EAW has been completed. It's waiting for funding. Another project is the North Ottawa project in the Bois de Sault Watershed District. This is of a picture of it in action this spring. It covers about 3 square miles. Is that right, Charlie? Yep, 3 square miles. And it's located near Tinta, Minnesota. It has 1,900 acres of floods, a 1,900 acre flood storage pool, plans for 8 interior pools, 160 acres each, which would be managed for migratory waterfowl and shorebirds. That's the one of those NRE components. And also built into the operation plan of this outlets into a tributary to the Rabbit River. It is to meter out flows for an extra month or so, depending on the spring event, to add flow to the Rabbit River. Many of the streams and rivers in the Red River Basin are very flashy. They come up fast in the spring, and then they go dry fairly quickly thereafter. This is the North Ottawa impoundment with a bunch of snow geese on it this spring, without having built these waterfowl pools yet. This last winter here, there was a moose roaming around out there, which is pretty unusual for this Tinta area of the state. This is a plan view of this North Ottawa impoundment. The left-hand side of your page is the deep end, and these pools, the A and B pools, are those wildlife pools that remain to be built as a natural resource enhancement piece of this. And this area has been designated by DNR as a game refuge area because of this intention to build these pools for wildlife as a migratory habitat. The last one we'll talk about here is the Red Path project on the Mistinka River. If you look at the Mistinka River was converted to Judicial Ditch 14 over 50 years ago. The natural meandering channel ends over here at Highway 9 on the right-hand side of the page, and then I think for about 34 miles it goes as JD 14. This project is multi-purpose. There's pools on the lower part or below the channel, the south side of the channel, that would be constructed similar to the ones you've seen in previous slides and other projects. And the plan here is to take and put the ditch from its existing narrow straight channel into a wider 350 foot wide floodway, build a floodway, and then put a natural, more natural meandering channel in that floodway. And then, similar to that Grand Marais project where there was a cutoff, this one, the Mistinka River was cut off here and lost about 9 miles of natural channel. Part of this project is to then divert flows into that natural channel. So this one has a lot of features. Flood pools, one of these would be managed for in the spring for northern pike spawning area. We've got recreation of, I think, 11 miles of sinuous channel and what now is 5 miles of ditch, and then reconnection of 9 miles of a disconnected river section. And there's the project features for you to review. Preliminary engineering is complete on this one also. And just sort of to give you some bearings on this, we are trying, you know, in the watershed district plans, there's lots of discussion of building complexes for habitat and building corridor areas, because we know from a wildlife perspective those are good things to have on the landscape. North Ottawa is this yellow area, and the Red Path area is in red with the town of Tinta just to the north. So I think that's my last slide for Ron to talk.
And I noticed, Mr. Van Offlin, on the Red Path project, you have pools that are right adjacent to the main channel of the river. And is the storage capacity much greater there? Because I would assume that the terrain, I'm looking at some of the other retention projects. It appeared that they were on fairly flat land, probably formerly farmland, and I would guess you have to take up a lot more acreage there in order to hold back a similar amount of water in a smaller pool on a river channel.
Mr. Chairman, on this one, it actually has very similar topographic features as those other projects. There's a point, and Charlie Anderson will be speaking a little bit later here. He may be able to give you a bit better answer, but we need enough relief from, you know, within a mile of distance in order for it to make it worth it to store water on those sections. And if the deeper the water, the more you can store there, you know, the more benefits, the more acres downstream, as I think how everybody's looking at it. So we you know, it needs to have the right topographic features.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Van Offlin. And Mr. Harnack, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ron Harnack. I'm project coordinator for the Red River Watershed Management Board. And the mediation agreement, when it was completed, laid out a funding strategy for the implementation of these complementary FDR and NRE projects. And it envisioned that where there were a significant amount of additional NRE built into these projects, that there would be a higher amount of state funding coming to the table. 75% state funding, 25% non-state, you know, was the starting point for that. But it also acknowledged that in some instances, based on the amount of NRE brought to the table, more funding than that should come from outside sources. Flood damage reduction is really the major priority for the districts in the basin. You all saw the flooding last year. You know, we can accomplish it by building levees higher, or we can integrate also upstream storage in combination with it so they function complementary for projects. We've attempted to find other dollars to come to the table. We've applied to the Outdoor Heritage Council, and so far we have not received a positive response from them to date. We're optimistic in the future because, quite candidly, there's about $120 million worth of projects on the table for FDR. The House bill has 50, the Senate bill has 70. Probably be somewhere in between. It's just a start at that 120 that Kent Lockesmull has on his list. So from our standpoint, as we look at these projects, we need to find other dollars that comes to the table to help with the non-FDR components if we're going to really be progressive about solving our problems in the Red River Valley. We've done all the work to make sure we've got integrated projects. However, if we do not bring other resources to the table, these NRE components will be delayed. It will cost more to construct them because they aren't constructed at the same time as the FDR, if they're constructed at all. And that, we feel, would be unfortunate. The funding challenges for the future. We got to find a way to bring more federal dollars to the table. The only dollars that come to the table now from the federal government is building dikes around cities and communities. You're fixing an immediate problem there. We need to have that done. But we can't ignore the rest of the economic community out there. When we build storage, we not only give additional risk reduction to those communities because we're holding more water back and reduce the peak, we're also protecting agricultural land and the rural infrastructure. And to date, unfortunately, we haven't found a way for the federal government to incorporate those kinds of things into their projects. So you see basically the cost of these being borne solely by the state of Minnesota and the local units of government. You will see a number of different pages in here, and I'm not going to go through them, Mr. Chairman. Our individual sheets on individual projects that the Red River Watershed Management has brought forward, both in terms of the mediation work group as well as for the individual community dike levees that they're proposing along the Red River. Our bottom line is we're actively pursuing flood damage reduction. We're integrating the NRE with these, which we think is a big plus for the Red River Basin. Mm-hmm. However, with the limited resources that are available, we don't believe we can continue to put the flood damage reduction dollars solely towards, put as much of the FDR dollars towards the NREs. We need to focus in on the FDRs.
Thank you, Mr. Harnack. And there was a question earlier from Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is some exciting stuff. Mr. Van Offlin, my question is, like, you had this slide that was, I think it's the Ottawa, yeah, North Ottawa component where the snow geese and the, is this land able to stay in private ownership, or are they able to farm it? Can the water, does the water come off soon enough to put crops on it?
Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, currently that land is being rented out to farmers, and they're growing crops on them right now. And ultimately, it would be our objective for the NRE is that some of those would be cropped as part of the management plan. Part of them would be shallow mud flats for shorebirds. Part of them would be managed as pools for migratory waterfowl. So we've worked out a management plan with the wildlife interests that is compatible with our flood damage reduction objectives.
Representative McNamara.
And so where we can, we're trying to keep as much of it in production where it makes sense. I mean, I think this is just really cool what we're doing here. But some of the more shallow ones, is that the intent? If they dry up enough, then the hope is. The ones that are more permanent, then do they become public ownership in those cases where the water's going to be on too long for them to be productive anymore?
Mr. Chairman and Representative McNamara, on this project in the North Ottawa, it's all publicly owned. It's owned by the Watershed District. We've got other projects where it's a combination of flowage easements and ownership, depending on, you know, what the expectation can be for the portions of the projects in terms of the landowners taking advantage of it. But we're using more and more easements in our projects to create greater flexibility.
Representative McNamara.
And then one different question. You had a picture of the Red Path project, and it was interesting how you're hopeful of, I don't think you've done this yet, but you're hopeful of putting the flow back where it used to be, which seems like a great idea. What are the legal challenges in doing that? I mean, do we have the right to be able to do that? I mean, it seems like it makes common sense, but those landowners haven't had water through there for a number of years. What's their reaction?
Mr. Van Offlin.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara. This is where working on this project team approach to things, we bring those landowners in as much as possible, given busy schedules. But, you know, and the watershed districts, I mean, that's one of the big, you know, issues with any of these projects, storing water in these pools. There's landowners involved. Making that ditch channel 350 or 400 foot wide, there's landowners involved. Doing the flow back into that area, much of this is dependent on landowners and cooperative landowners.
And Mr. Chairman, just to add on to that, Representative McNamara, you build these projects, and the benefit downstream for the agricultural lands and the rural infrastructure is really significant. You're minimizing the amount of flooding and crop losses that you're going to see by having these impoundments in place and managed properly. So you've got landowners, at least in these two areas, that have been very, very supportive of the projects moving forward. And we've had willing landowners in all of these instances.
And I do notice that we have both Representative Marquardt and Representative Lanning in the audience, and if you have any questions you want to ask, feel free to step forward and take a seat at the table if you so choose. So we do have a couple other questions here. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned, Mr. Van Hoflin, the bonding dollars that that may or may not, I guess, be forthcoming. But as I understand it, if they are, there may be some type of local match required. And does that present a problem in terms of your local funding some of these matching projects?
Mr. Harnack?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson. Right now, the Flood Damage Reduction Program, which is a grant through DNR, has a 50-50 state, local, or state, non-state match. The mediation agreement allows for, where there's significant environmental benefits associated with, for that to go up to 75% FDR funding and then 25% non-FDR funding. And that's been very helpful on some of these projects, you know, because they would have not gone forward otherwise. We pulled in some other funds into some of these projects as well. We've used RIM Reserve through Bowser. We've used the Working Lands Initiative dollars through DNR. We've used CRP on the federal program and tried to piggyback some of these so that we can get at least a permanent easement from landowners, because you can't, if you're going to build these kinds of projects, you can't have the operation of these things at risk down the road with just a 20-year. And the combination of these programs, and maybe with an additional kicker coming from the Watershed District, you know, to satisfy the land values, as many of you know, on the North Ottawa project, I believe it's fair to say when we started that, we were paying $920 an acre. Today, we're paying $3,200 plus. And so you've got to find other ways and means to be able to package things to make it happen.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Harnack, you were going through the acronyms and mentioned RIM. Could you maybe highlight what, with the last bonding bill in 08, I think we had provided $8 million of the $25 million for RIM WRP for the Valley, and just how that worked in conjunction with the NRE, and then the possibility of a WREP with this year's bonding bill.
Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen. Last year, the bonding bill, I forget how much it totally appropriated, but up to $8 million was available to the Red River Valley, and $6 million was allocated by Bowser to the Red River, and those were spent in areas on Spring Brook for buying buffers, were used on Grand Marais to buy buffering areas, and also on the south branch of the Buffalo Red River as well. And there's more that will likely be done if there are funding available. The WRP program, which is the Wetland Reserve Program, I know there's been a lot of push to try to get us to use that because of the federal leveraging. The problem is the federal government puts a limitation on the bounce that can be allowed on it. The Fish and Wildlife Service has basically said 1 foot. I think they've been able to negotiate on Manston Slough 1.2 feet. But through our Technical and Scientific Advisory Committee, which included Henry and engineers and other biological folks, we have come up and said you can get up to 2 feet of bounce for a 10-year summer flood. We aren't getting that through the WRP program. And until we do have some greater flexibility, we can't get the flood storage that's necessary through that program. We've had some discussions with NRCS here about a new program. Its focus is on the Mississippi River. It's called the Wetland Enhancement Program. And its focus is flood storage, water quality, and the secondary benefit being habitat. We feel that would be a very, very beneficial program for us with our impoundment proposals. That program still isn't out on the street. We don't know if the RFPs are going to allow for anything more than just the Mississippi River to be included, but we're trying.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
A follow-up then, Chair Eakin and Mr. Harnack. Would it be useful if you had a letter of support or something from the legislature relating to trying to provide you the flexibility that you needed in the, with the bounce to the federal government or to our congressional representatives to give you that flexibility? If we could support that maybe on a bipartisan, bicameral basis to help out with that.
Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I don't think it's ever lost when you state your perspective and, you know, to our congressional delegation, because I think that's, they look to us and they look to the legislature on, you know, for guidance and direction, and I think that would be a fair thing to do.
Has this been something that has been discussed in Washington at all, to your knowledge, as a possibility of allowing for a greater bounce?
We've had, Mr. Chairman, we've had those discussions, but the rules and regulations for WRP are pretty tight. It really doesn't give you a lot of flexibility in it. You know, straight rim gives you a lot. You know, we can work within the stuff that, you know, the TSAC group has developed. But in terms of the federal funding and using WRP, it's more a waste of time trying to get it than it is anything else at this point.
And I guess I was wondering as far as in Congress if there had been any discussion. But
we've had discussions with our congressional delegation on some of those issues.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we have Mr. Charlie Anderson. Welcome, Mr. Anderson. State your name and position for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Charles Anderson. I'm a civil engineer with JOR Engineering in Alexandria. I've been working with the watersheds in the Red River Valley for the last 34 years. What I plan to talk about today is a basin-wide flood flow reduction strategy. This is an effort really sponsored by the Red River Basin Commission. I've been working on a committee for the commission, along with other technical representatives from around the valley, and including Canada. Just for a little bit of background and orientation for those of you that aren't familiar, it's a map of the Red River Basin. The green area is the area that along the Red River itself, part of the old Agassiz Lake Plain, very flat. It's certainly the most flood-prone part of the Red River Basin. The upland areas tend to be prairie pothole topography. Some of those areas in particular, areas like Otter Tail River, have a lot of natural storage. We also have reservoirs at Red Lake, Upper Red Lake. On the North Dakota side, there's, of course, the Devil's Lake Basin, which up to now hasn't been contributing flood water, but certainly has the potential to do that in the future. This map shows the flooded area from the 1997 flood along the Red River itself. At this scale, it doesn't look necessarily that big, but it's up to about 10 miles wide, a very large area that's subject to flooding, and that's just along the main stem itself. Flooding is widespread throughout the Red River Basin. All of the photos that you see alongside this map are taken from areas not along the Red River itself, but along the major tributaries. As we look at how to reduce flood damages, there's basically two approaches. One is a protection type approach. There's been a lot of that done, certainly needs to be done. Those fall in the category of levees, channel improvements, including diversion channels, drainage improvements. On the other side are the flow reduction methods, impoundments or dams, something that we're focusing on because they can store a lot of water. Wetlands, of course, can store water. There's other plans out there, waffle storage, culvert sizing. They all play a role and really need to work together to come up with a comprehensive plan and approach. The protection strategies, necessary as they are, have a real drawback in that they tend to simply move the problem or the excess water from one area to another. That's why we're looking really hard, and have been looking hard, at flow reduction strategies, because they not only reduce the flooding in the targeted area, but they reduce it throughout the basin, particularly downstream, but also if we spread those throughout the basin, we can provide protection along the tributaries as well. Along with that, flow reduction strategies can provide additional benefits, and those can be integrated in to a great degree if we try to coordinate. Certainly reduced erosion, improved water quality, sustained stream flows that can provide water supply, wildlife enhancement opportunities, recreational opportunities. Protection strategies are generally single purpose and really provide, in most cases, no additional benefits. From that perspective, it would seem clear that flow reduction should be a base ingredient of a long-term basin-wide plan. And we've talked about that for years. We've certainly been working at it. But there are a lot of questions that were difficult to answer, and we've been striving to answer through that effort by the Basin Commission. Those key questions, in my mind, are how much can be accomplished with flow reduction? We need to have an idea of what's feasible. How would you implement it? How long will it take to implement it? And how much would it cost? And what does that leave behind, or what would still remain to be done after you implement as much flow reduction as you reasonably can? In developing a flow reduction plan, really the determining factors are what's technically possible, of course, what's economically practical, socially acceptable, politically doable, and in consideration of those elements, try to determine or come to an agreement of how much storage should be done, what's reasonably foreseeable, then establish a goal to reach that level of flow reduction. Once that level's been established, then it's much easier to plan how high your levees, for example, would have to be, what the size of a diversion would need to be. The Basin Commission's approach to this, obviously the storage has to be in the upper watersheds, but how do we allocate that, determine an amount that each tributary watershed needs to provide in the way of flow reduction. And as we look at that, and we'll have to work closely with the individual watershed areas, but one factor, of course, is which areas are most important or will have the most effect on the main stem. But also it's equally important to look at the flood damages that occur within those watersheds and try to solve both at the same time. In other words, if we can solve a flooding problem in a tributary area by holding water back, we'll not only benefit that area, we'll also benefit the main stem, or vice versa. So very important that we get an understanding of each area's needs. Then also look at multi-purpose opportunities. It might not be the perfect spot for flood damage reduction, but it might be a perfect spot or implementing wildlife habitat or some associated benefit. See how that all can work together. Then, of course, there's the local implementation capacity. And all areas aren't equal in that regard, but certainly watershed districts on the Minnesota side have demonstrated a capability of putting storage in place. Well, to try to get at that allocation question and figure out how much storage needs to be provided on each tributary. Basin Commission developed a Mike 11 model. It's a complex model, but really the concept is relatively simple. The purpose, of course, of the model is to figure out what the effect would be on the main stem if you hold back flow on each tributary. Again, looking at a map of the basin, each of the red dots that are shown here are gauging stations that the USGS has. They measure flow continuously at those sites, so we know how much water is coming into the Red River at each of those locations. Also along the river, the yellow dots are areas where, or locations rather, where they measure flow on the Red River. We started out with an initial goal of 20%. If we could reduce the peak flows on the main stem by 20%, and the flood that we used to analyze this is the 1997 flood. The 1997 flood was widespread throughout the entire basin. Almost all tributaries had major flooding. So it's a good representative flood, probably in the neighborhood of about a 100-year event. The allocation strategy, we followed what I think is a logical progression. Started at the upstream end. The Red River, of course, runs north. We started at the south end and began reducing flows there. And then when we had reduced the flows on the tributaries at the south end enough to get 20%, just worked our way north, adding more storage to achieve the goal, all the way to Emerson at the Canadian border. Our model, the Mike 11 model, runs all the way from Lake Traverse to Lake Winnipeg. We haven't done or haven't carried out the allocation all the way to Lake Winnipeg yet, but we certainly intend to do that. At this point, we've got it as far as the Canadian border. I'm going to just go through this real briefly, but just to give you a flavor of what we did. At the south end, shown here by the brown hydrograph, is the flow that leaves Lake Traverse at the very upstream end of the Red River system. The line right below that represents a reduced flow, out of White Rock. So for those of you that aren't familiar with hydrographs, we're looking at the amount of flow increasing on the vertical scale, and then just calendar days on the horizontal. This is the amount of flow that came out of White Rock during the 1997 flood. That's a gate-controlled reservoir. The operating philosophy on that, and it's operated by the Corps, is they keep the gates closed during any flood event until the reservoir is full. When it's full, we have no choice but to open the gates. That's what happened at this point, relatively early in the flood, and certainly those releases contributed a lot to the flood at Breckenridge and on to Fargo. So keeping that same operating strategy, we just said, okay, if you could store more water upstream from that dam, actually upstream from Lake Traverse, we could delay that gate opening by about 4 days. That's what's built into the model. Enough storage so that the gates don't open until 4 days later than they did in 1997. Well, the effect at Breckenridge is what's shown by the upper two lines. The flood at Breckenridge in 1997 is represented by the red line, the highest flow rate there. By storing more water at Lake Traverse, we reduce the flow at Breckenridge to the blue line. You can see it has a major impact, but as you might expect, not quite enough to get the 20%. So working with the other tributaries, the Rabbit River, the Ottertail River, reduced flow on those tributaries to get it down to a 20% reduction that's shown here with the lower blue line. Then, again, same kind of strategy. How much good did that do at Fargo-Moorhead? If we simply controlled the flows at Wahpeton Breckenridge, how much would that reduce the flood at Fargo? And that's shown by the upper lines here. The red is reduced down to the blue. Again, not 20%, but it did certainly show that by controlling flows in the upstream area, solving or reducing the flood at Wahpeton Breckenridge does carry over and reduce the flood at Fargo-Moorhead. We went all the way around the basin, of course, looked at all the tributaries. I won't go into detail on these, but you can generally see the strategy. All of those tributaries, with the exception of the Upper Otter Tail River, required some flow reduction. And it's in varying amounts. In determining which water is most important to store, we look primarily at timing. And if you think about it, it's kind of just kind of a logical way of looking at contribution. If you're in an area where the water runs out fairly early in a flood, you really don't want to store that water that would have made it downstream without causing any problems. Conversely, if you're out here in the late area, you know, that would have less immediate impact. It's not to say that those two areas don't contribute to the flood, but they contribute at a different part of the flood. Then you have the middle area where the peak flow on the tributary tends to be coincident. Well, let me just show you again just a series of quick hydrographs here. At White Rock, that's in a late area. Okay, we want to store the early water from the late area to get the most impact on the main stem. That's what we did at White Rock. The Sand Hill River watershed, that's in the area of Climax, tends to be coincident with the peak on the red. So our strategy there is to try to reduce the peak on that tributary, and if we reduce the peak on it, it should automatically reduce the peak on the main stem. Going further north, this is the south branch of two rivers. It's at Lake Bronson. That water tends to come out early. Okay. Well, you want to store the late water from the early areas to get the most bang for the buck on the main stem. Well, following that strategy, we developed a tributary reduction allocation for each watershed. Averaged, if you look at it on the major contributing tributaries, we needed to reduce the peaks by about 35%. So to get 20% reduction on the main stem took a peak flow reduction of about 35% on the tributaries. That's looking at it from a peak standpoint. Storage, of course, is all about volume. It took 885,000 acre feet of flow reduction to accomplish that, and that's equivalent to about 13% of the water that went down the Red River during that 1997 spring flood. This table shows the allocation. There is a copy of that in your handout, and I think most of the numbers there are legible, but it's really there more to show you how we'll deliver the message or the needed information to the individual sub-watersheds or watersheds. But what's shown in that table is how much peak flow reduction we need on that tributary, how much volume of water needs to be removed from their tributary hydrograph, and whether they should target early water from that watershed or peak water or late water in figuring out where the storage is needed to have the most impact on the main stem. Results are shown on this map. These are all points along the Red River. As I said before, we were shooting for 20% reduction. We were able to get 20% reduction at each of the yellow main stem gauge locations. I'll just take a bit closer look at one of those hydrographs. This is at Drayton. That's north of Grand Forks, between Grand Forks and the Canadian border. We have the 20% reduction, but you can see there's a reduced flow throughout the entire flood hydrograph. So not only are we reducing the peak, we're reducing the duration of the flood. It also leaves room for doing things a little bit differently or a little bit less exactly. This is not perfect storage. It's reasonably achievable storage that goes into making that flow reduction throughout the entire hydrograph. One thing, though, that has to be kept in mind is that we took water out of that flood, but if we do that by storage, which is the most likely way to do most of it, at some point we have to add that water back in. We can't hold it forever. We have to release it. The plan, of course, the ideal plan would be to hold it until the river is back in bank or at least below a damage level. At Drayton, that would be about 45,000 CFS. So when the flood recedes to about this level, we can start letting water back out. And then we would have to let it back out. That's not shown on this hydrograph, but we'd have to let it back out over about the next month before those reservoirs could all be drawn back down. Looking at the main stem, this table summarizes the results. Like I said, we are reducing peak flows by 20%, but really the most important thing for most people living there is what effect would that have on flood levels. At Wahpeton Breckenridge, the reduction would be about 2.8 feet. This is the model from 1997. There's been a diversion built around Wahpeton Breckenridge. I have not tried to figure out what the flow reduction or stage reduction would have been with a diversion in place, but without it, it would have been about 2.8 feet. At Fargo, Fargo-Moorhead, about 2 feet. At Halstead, about 1.2 feet. At Grand Forks, about 2.7 feet. At Drayton, about 1.2 feet. At Emerson, about 0.8 feet. Let me back up to Grand Forks. Had this flow reduction been in place in 1997, I believe, and I think most people believe, that the levees at Grand Forks and East Grand Forks would not have failed. You never know for sure, but it's within what they could much more reasonably have dealt with. If we do it by storage, ideally you could do it with about 885,000 acre feet. As a practical matter, particularly as we aim at controlling some of the local flooding at the same time, it'll take more than that. But I don't. I think we're close. We're in the ballpark. We have to remember, though, that what we're doing is removing flow from that hydrograph and not adding it back in during the flood. And to do that, most, if not all of that, at 885,000 acre feet, would have to be high quality gate controlled storage. We don't let it out during the flood. Other types of storage, ungated storage, wetland storage, many of those that don't have controls on, still very useful. They'll help to reduce the peak. They're just somewhat less efficient. Looking at cost, economic feasibility of achieving such a goal, the current cost of gate-controlled storage seems to be running about $1,000 an acre foot. Not that long ago, it was more like $400 or $500. The price certainly has been rising for a number of reasons. Land costs, for one, and simply inflation. But another thing to consider is, you know, you kind of do the easiest sites first. So as you work through this, it's likely that the cost of an individual site would increase. taking that $1,000 an acre foot, though, and looking at about 1 million acre feet of storage required would get you an overall cost of about $1 billion. The benefits of such a program, obviously reduce flood magnitudes. Put it in different terms, the 100-year flood on the main stem would tend to be like a 50-year flood. On the tributaries, because we're looking at about a 35% reduction there, tributary areas like Crookston on the Red Lake River, their 100-year flood would be more like a 25-year flood. So the frequency of major floods then would basically be less. Infrastructure damages throughout the basin, wherever these are implemented, would be reduced. Agricultural damages reduced. Increased crop production efficiency. Earlier planting, things like that, increase the agricultural production. Also, where you have current levees in place, many of the urban areas, farmsteads already have levees. Those levees then would have higher level of protection because they would be facing less frequent flooding or flood levels. It also reduces the cost of providing future protection enhancements to some of the communities that have inadequate protection systems now. How long would it take to implement it? Historically, and again, I've been working at this for a long time in the Red River Basin, the amount that we've been able to achieve has been about 10,000 acre feet per year. We had a period in there when we didn't get a lot done, but that's another issue. But when we've been progressively building impoundments, a rate of 1,000 acre or 10,000 acre feet per year hasn't been hard to sustain. At that rate, if you're looking at 1 million acre feet, it would take you about 100 years. With a much more concerted effort, focus both in financing and other stronger effort, it could possibly be done within 25-year period. But that, I think, kind of frames it. Anywhere from 25 to 100 years to implement a 20% flow reduction strategy. It seems like a long time, certainly longer than most of us will be around. But one thing to keep in mind is as you build each of these, you get an increment of improved benefits. So it's not like you have to wait till they're all constructed to begin having dividends. I just want to look a little bit at a vision of the future with and without flow reduction. Without flow reduction, one of the things that isn't talked about much, but I certainly believe it's a reality, is that the flood levels will increase. They won't stay the same. Status quo really isn't achievable. It will get worse. And the reason I say that is because of the widespread flooding in the basin. There's problems throughout the basin that need to be solved. If they're not solved by flow reduction, they'll be solved by other ways. And those other ways, now we're in the protection side, tend to move the problem to another area, particularly downstream. So if we don't solve the basin-wide problems with flow reduction, flows will get higher. The problems on the main stem will continue to increase. And frankly, I don't really see an end in sight. At some point, I suppose, it will cease to get worse when all the problems have been addressed. But for the foreseeable future, if we don't implement flow reduction, basin-wide flow reduction, the problems on the main stem or anywhere downstream will have a tendency to get worse. With flow reduction, flow reductions on the tributaries will reduce main stem flood levels. Widespread flood damages on the tributaries will be reduced. Existing ditches, diversions, and the natural channels that serve as drain outlets will tend to become more adequate, maybe even adequate. Existing levees will provide greater levels of protection without needing to be raised. Raising levees can reduce the frequency that they might be overtopped, but it increases the magnitude, excuse me, of the catastrophe that would occur if they're overtopped. So this really provides a way to get better protection out of lower, therefore safer levees. Certainly don't want to underestimate the opportunity for multi-purpose resource enhancement at the same time that can go along with projects of this type. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Representative Marquardt.
Question. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate you holding this hearing on Red River Valley flooding. That's very much, and I think it shows the great importance of coordination among all the entities and team players here when you're dealing with flood prevention. So thank you all. The question, this has been very interesting, but, you know, of course, the big proposal, in, you know, right now is the Fargo-Moorhead diversion, you know, $1 billion to $1.3, $1.4 billion, and you're talking about potentially downstream storage bringing down the river level by about 2 feet, which certainly could impact the size of the diversion channel ultimately. And also as we look at downstream with, and I know Representative Beacon, you've talked a lot about this, the increase of the diversion on levels in Purley and in Hendrum and Halstead and so forth, with the idea that the diversion would probably be, depending on what side you went, 7 to 9 to 10 years at the earliest for completion, are there some things we could do now where you talk about, you know, I know Hendrum's about a 10 or 11 inch impact for that diversion. Are there some things we could do now? And I know, you know, North Ottawa project and some of these other ones are already making a difference, but anything in the next 7 to 9 years, I know it's 25 years for the whole works and $1 billion, that could be done in that time that would, you know, help Purley and Hendrum and Halstead and those? And then are there any federal funds that can come into these type of storage or impoundment projects?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the funding issues would be better addressed perhaps by Ron or other members, but if you look at upstream from Fargo-Moorhead on the 20% reduction strategy that we developed, it would take about 200,000 acre feet of storage upstream from that, those communities. The impact, the downstream impact of putting in a diversion, of course it depends on the size, but just doing some rough runs of the model, it seems like about 100,000 acre feet, or roughly half of that 20% reduction, would need to be incorporated in order to fully mitigate those downstream impacts. And I'm throwing that out as a rough number. We haven't run it. We certainly haven't looked at the range of alternatives that the Corps is looking at. But to try to answer your question, you'd want to try to get about half of that in place then as quickly as you could to mitigate the downstream impacts.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Marco.
Thank you, Representative Eakin. Mr. Anderson, you said 100,000. And what were you saying we could possibly do a year? I forget that number. What did you usually say? How many acre feet could you do in a year?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think 10,000 is a reasonable number, so that would get you a 10-year span. I need to point out, of course, that about half of that ideally would be on the other side of the river. It doesn't have to be. I think it's within reason that we could do that all on the Minnesota side, but then we would be waiting for the North Dakota side to do the other half of the 20% reduction.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. And Mr. Anderson, as far as cost comparison with the diversion, it seems, and you're saying that it would only require really half of that 20% reduction in order to achieve the goal of mitigating for the downstream impact in a 100-year event or a flood similar to what we experienced last year. So it sounds like, as far as cost comparison, the retention projects would not be as expensive as the diversion. So I'm just wondering, as far as where it would fall in terms of how it compares with diversion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members, the 20% reduction at Fargo-Moorhead is about a 5,000 CFS reduction in flow. So as you look at the options that the Corps is looking at, which range in size from 20,000 to 35,000, I believe, CFS capacity, you can see that the upstream storage, at least at the 20% level, doesn't provide the same amount.
Sure.
But it would, if implemented, reduce the size of the required diversion by about that amount, about 5,000. So if you were otherwise going to build a 20,000 CFS diversion, you could look at maybe 15,000 instead.
Okay. So, and it would require a 20% reduction to mitigate then for downstream impact of a diversion of what size? If you've got a 20,000 CFS diversion, would the 20% reduction on the tributaries, would that mitigate completely for the downstream impact?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in my opinion, that would be more than what would be required for mitigation. The downside, of course, the 20% flow reduction strategy goal was to reduce those flows along the entire length of the Red River. If we have to put a lot of storage in place simply to mitigate, then ideally we would put more storage in place so that we would get that flow reduction, not only at Fargo-Moorhead, but say at Hendrum or all the points downstream. So if you put the diversion in, you would require then more storage to achieve the same end result, you know, at those locations.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Anderson, as the public invests in the impoundments and the remeanders and that, is there any other policy activity that's taking place that deals with more prevention? Looking at some of the maps, I see a lot of straight lines that are still there. And are there petitions that are occurring to the drainage authorities to clean out ditches or to ask for redetermination that would accelerate the drainage at the same time that you're investing public dollars to try to slow drainage? How are the drainage authorities, whether they're the counties or the watershed districts, responding to that pressure, either from landowners or improvements to the drainage systems?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think the watershed districts in particular are very careful in what's allowed in terms of drainage improvements. And that does tend to reduce the potential, I think, for things to get worse. But as I said earlier, the problems need to be solved. The traditional way has been put in better ditches, deeper ditches, bigger ditches, and for the most part, unless that's done very carefully, that would tend to increase the problem downstream. So I think, again, we have to offer a good alternative for those areas that would otherwise need a bigger ditch. We need to offer a good alternative that won't move the problem downstream. So if we can get storage broadly distributed or widely distributed throughout the basin, upstream from each of those problem areas, then they'll have no reason to accelerate the flow. So that's part of the strategy. Is to prevent things from getting worse.
Okay. Okay, Representative Hansen.
Just to follow up, so are requests still coming in for cleanouts and accelerating the drainage?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, yes, certainly cleanouts, which, you know, viewed generally as maintenance, is done on a routine basis. That all of the legal ditch systems out there and most of the private, you'll see some of that maintenance. Typically on the legal drains, maybe every 10 years, you go in and do a clean out. That simply gets it back to the point of what it was designed to do. It doesn't accelerate it or make it worse. There are some petitions that we see for doing actual improvements, then not just maintenance. Those would have a tendency to move the water downstream faster. But we look or take very seriously what's in the statute about adequacy of the outlet and design those systems. We don't see a lot of petitions for that, but when we do, to include flow control on it. Also, just to give an example in the Bois du Sault Watershed District, they will grant a permit allowing a drainage improvement, but only if there's a restricted outlet. So in many cases, if a farmer is asking permission to improve his field drainage, he's required at the same time as a condition on that permit to put in a smaller pipe or to throttle the existing pipe. So we feel quite comfortable under that set of rules that things aren't getting worse from drainage activities.
Okay. I thought I'd also just recognize that Representative Olin is here as well, and feel free to step forward if you have any questions. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, you mentioned that Lake Traverse was a key water-holding area, and it was a late discharging area. Any chance that something like that could be drawn down earlier so it would have more water holding capacity later on during a flood, something like that?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the Corps actually modified its operating plan some years back to allow for additional drawdown in anticipation of a big flood. They measure the water content out in the watershed, in the snowpack. If it exceeds 3 inches, then they draw the reservoir down an additional couple of feet. They have already determined that they've got over 3 inches, and they will begin that drawdown on March 1.
Yeah, thanks. And I think we'll do one more question and then move on to the next presentation. We do still have some more presentation left. So
I can wait.
Oh, thank you. And I want to thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you.
So next we have Mr. Lance Yohe from the Red River Basin Commission. Welcome, Mr. Yohe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lance Yohe. I'm Executive Director of the Red River Basin Commission. I live in Fargo, North Dakota. I manage an office for the commission in Moorhead, Minnesota, and also one in Winnipeg, Manitoba. So I want to tell you a little bit about who we are and what we do. And what we're trying to do based on what Charlie just talked to you and how we're trying to tie that together with the appropriation we received from you. This is our interim report that was submitted on January 15th. It's in your packet. If you have any questions on that, our website's there, my phone number, call me directly if you want, we'll talk about it. But we're a nonprofit registered in the United States. We're also a charity registered in Canada. And we're working on Red River Basin water management issues, and I'll show you a picture in a minute. We have a 41-member board. It includes three that the governor of Minnesota appoints, and you see in the bottom who they are: DNR Commissioner Mark Holston, PCA Commissioner Paul Ager, Minnesota Board and Water Soil Resource Executive Director John Jasky. The governor of Minnesota does similar. The premier of Manitoba does the same, and South Dakota governor puts one person on our board. We also have 10 local people in Minnesota on our board. They are two from the counties, two from the watershed districts, one from the tribes, one from the environmental community, one citizen elected, and three mayors. And that makes up our Minnesota board. North Dakota does similar, Manitoba does similar, and South Dakota has one. We also try to connect to the federal agencies and the elected officials that work in the region, and their staff people come to our board meetings, and we invite all the federal agencies to come and visit with us once a year. They're all ex officio on our board. They're welcome to come any board meeting they want and participate. This is the Red River Basin. You've heard Charlie talk about it a bit. It's about a 50,000 square mile area. It starts down Lake Traverse in the south in South Dakota, moves up to Lake Winnipeg in the north, that lake on the right-hand side there. And that lake is the 10th largest freshwater lake in the world. And all of the water in the Red River Basin ends up there, crossing the international boundary up by Pemmon and Emerson. And because it crosses the international boundary flowing north, that creates issues for us on this side, because the Red River is regulated by an international treaty between the United States and Great Britain when Canada was still part of the Commonwealth, and it's called the International Boundary Joint Commission Treaty. And the Joint Commission, the International Joint Commission monitors that treaty, and we're particularly concerned in our area about water quality issues, which are exacerbated by flooding, particularly in the spring and summertime. Charlie told you the geography of the area. It's very flat. The water moves north. It usually moves north into icebound water, so it can't flow through as quick as we'd like it to. It creates problems for us. Not only do we have these kind of issues there, we have the jurisdictional issues. We have three states and a province, and the two states, Minnesota and North Dakota and South Dakota, the two Dakotas operate under Western water law. Minnesota operates under Eastern water law. That affects how we allocate water, how we manage in-stream flows, how we work on all kinds of issues related to water management. In addition to that, there are at least 23 federal agencies that we know of between the two countries that work in the Red River. For some reason, the Red River is the dividing line between all federal agencies, east and west. So we'll have an EPA region out of Chicago, an EPA region out of Denver. We have a core office in Omaha, a core office in St. Paul. We have Denver and Chicago again for Fish and Wildlife and other agencies. So they all break down differently, and then we have the Canadian ones on top of it. So there's just a lot of issues, a lot of agencies, a lot of jurisdictional things, a lot of boundaries, things that we're trying to work on. And that's why the Red River Basin Commission has been evolving since the 1980s to end up where it is today. After the 1979 flood, a lot of local mayors, Mayor Lanning was mayor of Moorhead at that time, and other mayors up and down the valley said, enough's enough. We're getting flooded all the time. Let's do something about it. They formed a group. That went on and got people connected at the grassroots level. In the 90s, another group kind of formed where the states were trying to figure out how to do a permitting on a Red River plant to produce sucrose. And so that group kind of formed. And then in 2000, early 2000, we merged all that together. So we have now is a very good local, state, provincial organization with everybody talking to each other, everybody working together towards the same purposes. And what we're trying to do is get people to think about this basin, where we want it to go, what we want to do, how we're going to do it together. And we've been working on things like what Charlie showed you on the flow reduction for the flood damage. We're also working on water quality compacts between the three jurisdictions. We're looking at water supply issues. How do we set up agreements between the jurisdictions before we get into a drought so that we end up in lawsuits because we're all trying to use the Red River for our drinking water. We haven't agreed how to do that. Things like that. We're trying to do whatever we can to move that dialogue forward and get cooperation ahead of time on what needs to be done. Well, the 2009 flood was the impetus for some funding from Minnesota, North Dakota, to help us try to tie all these things together in the Red River Basin related to flooding. And so that's what we're trying to do, and I'll just give you a quick update on that. We've been around all over the basin talking to people after the flood. We put on 21 public meetings. We've had upwards of 100, 150 people at those talking to us about their experience, what they think the problem is, where it's coming from, what we should do about it. We've got surveys out to the public. That number is over 1,000 now of people that are going to our website telling us what they think. We've got surveys out to all the counties, all the water boards, all the watershed districts, all the cities in the Red River Valley on the U.S. side, and about 3/4 of those are back, and we're following up on those now. We want to know what they are experiencing in terms of damages, what things they got on the books that can be worked on to solve problems. We're also trying to leverage the state funding at the federal level. The Army Corps of Engineers has a basin-wide feasibility study going on. We've been using your money and North Dakota's money to leverage more federal money to help us take some of the LIDAR data that you funded on another project with the International Water Institute at NDSU, Tri-College actually, and to help take that information and get it to local people so they can make better decisions about things and get involved more in the process. So we're doing some things with that. The main stem modeling capabilities that Charlie talked about, we've been working on that. We're enhancing that right now. The digital elevation stuff I talked about. The other thing that we're trying to do is in each of the watersheds like Bois de Sioux and Wild Rice in Minnesota and the Buffalo Red and the Sand Hill, they all have models that work on the watershed. What the Corps is doing now is working and trying to get all those models the same on both sides of each river, of the river, North Dakota and Minnesota, so they're all the same, apples to apples. Then we're going to start modeling in each of those watersheds to do what Charlie's talking about more specifically, to get more detail, so that instead of just Charlie saying, okay, this is kind of what we can do in our watershed, we're going to test that out with a model. That model that he's going to run for us, he's going to be starting on that up in the Bois de Sioux watershed, we'll link it to the main stem model so we'll get more specific modeling information from their watershed as it relates to those 20% flow numbers on the main stem Red River that we're trying to target using the Mike 11 model. So we're going to be doing that watershed by watershed starting in the south as the Corps builds those models. And this is my last slide. I just want to wrap up with this one. In order to help you understand how that comes together, this is a HEC-RAS depiction of a model that the Army Corps of Engineers uses HEC-RAS. We use Mike 11. They're two unsteady flow models where you can vary the level of the river. The Corps doesn't have theirs complete yet, but it will be by the end of this year from Lake Traverse to their national boundary. Now, ours goes to Lake Winnipeg, so we can bring Manitoba into the equation, and eventually we hope to be able to show Manitoba that the flood damage reduction stuff we're doing in the U.S. is having a positive impact on them as the water flows into Manitoba, so we can make a case for them to help cost sharing with us in the U.S. on flood storage projects. And there's some interest in Manitoba to do that, so we're going to try to push that envelope as we move along. Now, you've heard about the Fargo-Moorhead Diversion Project. One of the things that people want to get a better handle on is if you take 20% flows out, like Charlie said, will that really have an impact as that water moves through Fargo and goes around on a diversion on either side so you can take that 10.5 inches off down by Hendra? And so what's happening now, last Friday, a study was authorized to do some more modeling that we're going to cost share in with the Watershed Board in North Dakota, and we've got two engineering firms that are going to ask this through the Fargo-Moorhead Reach from south of Fargo at Hixson to north down to Halsted. And if you look real close, all the little lines that are on this, right on the river, those are all cross-section lines. So we have a lot more data, it's a lot more detailed, it's a lot more specific. So we're going to ask the question on the 10.5 inches from there on those storage at points like Hixson and on the Abercrombie area, on the Buffalo where it comes in, on the Wild Rice where it comes in. And then we're going to try to link it back to the Mike 11 model. So when Charlie says we can get 20% coming off the Bois de Sioux, we're going to bring it down to Hixson. We're going to be able to flow that around Fargo and say, okay, that's going to have this much impact on those inches that are going around Fargo that are being raised. It's going to take that much off. So we're going to get more specific with that and be able to address that. And this model is going to be done probably in about a month, and the Bois de Sioux stuff will be done about a month later than that. So we're going to start tying that stuff together real fast. We expect by next year report to you on our final recommendations to be able to make sense of all this for you, basin-wide, North Dakota, Minnesota, as we tie all this together for flood damage reduction strategies that include everything that people are talking about and things we might want to consider doing. The diversion in Fargo-Moorhead is going to protect the last major metropolitan area in the Red River, along the Red River, that still doesn't have protection above the last flood that they just experienced. So whatever we do there, that's going to help a lot. but there's still a lot of outlying areas that have problems, a lot of things that storage can do for us in the local area as well as on the main stem.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Yohe. Any questions at all? Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I had three quick questions, Mr. Yohe. Or first, I hope you all carpooled down.
Some of us did.
Okay. You know, you're talking about coordination is important. I guess if you can't sit in a car for 4 hours, then.
Yeah.
You were talking about the difference between Eastern and Western law. Are you talking about the difference between is it prior appropriation and riparian water rights? Is that what you're talking about?
Mr. Yohe.
Representative Gardner, yes, that's okay. What I'm talking about.
And then second question, what's the U.S. population in the Red River Basin, more or less, wherever the decimal point is?
Oh.
Mr. Yohe?
That's a good question. Let me guess. Let me think here. Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, the Fargo-Moorhead area is about 200,000. I don't know what Grand Forks, maybe half of that, 100,000. So all the outlying areas, maybe 500,000, I'm guessing.
Okay. And then the last question, we've heard about, you know, time release and water retention and gates and so on. I'm just sort of curious, in a crisis, who's pushing the button or makes the decision? It sounds like there's a lot of actions that have to happen in a coordinated fashion. And I mean, it sounds like after going through several crises, you've figured something out. But I'm just curious, who's the person who says, all right, let the water out over here? And there's just a lot of jurisdictions that are overlapping. I'm just curious who calls the shots when you're really in a pinch and, sure, and hours count.
Good question. Mr. Yohe.
Chairman, Representative Gardner. In both Minnesota and North Dakota, they have local watershed boards. In Minnesota, they're called watershed districts by watershed boundaries. In North Dakota, they're called water resource districts inside county boundaries. Both of them have joint boards. And both those joint boards are working on things together jointly now, like drainage. What does drainage do for us? What's the impact? What's the economic value? What does it do to flooding? So they're beginning a process of looking at that, jointly funding things together. So when we look at all this stuff and you try to tie it all together this way and you look at what they're doing, the watershed districts are working. And so when, like in the Minnesota side, you have the Bois de Sioux watershed, the Buffalo watershed, the Wild Rice, the Sand Hill, all up and down. Those are the watershed boards that operate how things are released. Now, North Dakota tends not to build gated structures. They build dams that when they get so high, they automatically overflow. So they build their management in ahead of time up front. And so there's different ways to do that. So when you're using a gated structure, there'll be an operating plan put in place at the beginning, and that's how they'll do it. The Corps does the same thing on Bald Hill Dam, Lake Traverse, and Orwell.
Okay, Mr. Chair, as a follow-up. So in an emergency, when you do have flooding, and it really is important that things are timed properly so you don't bottleneck everything all at once. You've got some emergency operations center somewhere, and all of these watershed districts and others are linked in somewhere. You just open the notebook and say, time to call Bob in this town and let it rip.
Mr. Yohe.
Representative Gardner, it's not quite that simple, but because it doesn't happen through emergency management, it happens through the watershed board. But if the remember that graph Charlie showed you, early, middle, late? We know from studies that have been done in the past by the Red River Watershed Management Board and the Army Corps of Engineers, we have a pretty good feel for where the water is coming from as it comes down the river and hits the peaks and the hydrographs. And that's partly based on terrain. What the wild card in this is every year is the kind of thaw we get and where the water's piling up in the snowpack. And so it changes things. So like, for instance, Charlie talked about the 97 flood and how they released water from White Rock after it got full. Well, in 2009, the recent flood we had, that wasn't even full down there because it was all coming from other areas. So every flood is a little different. And one of the challenges in managing this is you need to set your goals. You need to say, we need to try to get here. And then you need to start looking at a number of different floods to see how they relate to each other and try to do the best you can with this. These are just tools to help us make better decisions and move us in the right direction. And the right direction is to reduce flood damages, reduce risk, and protect as many people as we can, and enhance those projects with other things along the way if we can do that as well. And so you can use gated structures, you can use ungraded structures. The gated ones is where the management comes in.
Thank you. And that information that you're going to be getting in a month or in 2 months, as you're starting to get more information on the projections, would be very helpful as you get that information to understand what the downstream impact will be as far as the retention projects. And that's one of the things I was trying to get at, I guess, when I was talking to Mr. Anderson as well. And I understand you were talking about 25 years if it was a more aggressive pursuit of these projects. But you were saying that you're going to start upstream, obviously, because that'll have the largest impact, starting upstream and then move downstream. So the part above Fargo-Moorhead would probably be accomplished in half the time than that 25-year period. And I guess what I'd like to know is what would it take in that area above or upstream from Fargo-Moorhead to mitigate for the downstream impact, and also what the cost would be. And then, Mr. Anderson, I don't know if you could elaborate any more on the cost factor. I was just wondering, as far as getting a 20% reduction above Fargo-Moorhead, what would be the total cost of that? And I'm just wondering if, because it appears to me that it's comparable to, or maybe even less than, the diversion itself, which wouldn't make it cost prohibitive. It seems to me that it's if it's comparable at all to what the diversion would be, it's certainly something that is within reach as far as its cost factor is concerned.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, yes, I think it is within reach. If we look at the need for, say, a minimum of 100,000 acre feet of storage upstream from Fargo, I believe, again, based on current costs, that would be about $100 million, which in comparison then with the diversion project at Fargo-Moorhead, which is in the billion-dollar range, depending on the option, you know, it's not a major percentage relative to that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Yohe.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just to make sure everybody's clear on this, the 100,000 Charlie's talking about doesn't negate the need for a diversion. It's just how we're trying to address that 10.5-inch stage increase from the diversion.
Sure, sure.
The Corps of Engineers has said that there's not enough upstream storage to get away from needing a diversion or some kind of levees or something. And they said, you know, the best they can come up with is maybe 300,000-400,000 acre feet of storage up there to get a 2-foot stage decrease. And they're talking on the diversion a 5-7-foot stage decrease. So we're talking about is how do you mitigate that raise so there's no adverse impacts by that project on somebody else. And at the same time, protect this 200,000 population center without hurting other people.
Right. And I want to make it clear, I would certainly understand, you know, that there is going to be a diversion and that would be part of the solution here. But just wanted to get a handle on what it would cost to mitigate for the downstream impact and how much it would take to do that. So thank you very much for your testimony. Very interesting.
Thank you.
Very helpful. Representative Saylor did have a question. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, this is more of a comment than a question, as I've been reviewing the information that you have here and certainly things from the past. Specifically, looking at your very illustrative slide on page 15 about the flooding history, you know, it's pretty obvious. You start looking at about 1945 or so, and you kind of watch a lot of the black marks kind of moving on up. And I would venture to guess that if we had a similar slide next to that talked about the amount of money that we spent on dealing with the flooding, it would have a similar trend. You know, I guess my thought on this is I hope we get this right this time. You know, we apparently thought we were fixing something a while ago, and now we're, you know, having so much damage to people's homes, to their livelihoods, to everything. It's extremely disruptive, and, you know, I think we, as people, yes, in general, like to think we know a lot of things. Sometimes we find out we don't, but I really, really hope that we're working very hard at getting it right this time so that we can kind of level off in the expense and in the impact that we have on the resource and on people's lives.
And Mr. Yohe.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Saylor, I agree with that 100%. And one of the things we're working on right now are some basin flood damage reduction principles that we want people to buy into. Also with that, then, are what levels of protection do we think we want to get to? I mean, Winnipeg has 700-year protection now with their recent improvement on their floodway. Grand Forks, after the 97 flood, has protection of 250 years on paper, maybe above that, what they could actually do. Fargo's talking 500 years. Okay, so what we need to know is, that, is there, are those levels reasonable to try to attain? What's it going to cost to get there? Are local people willing to pay to help get there? And how much are they willing to pay? That's part of the questions we want them to answer for us as we lay this out and bring it back to you. I mean, it's a partnership, and we need to figure out if we can get federal money in this partnership some way, the ways we haven't, to get to those levels of protection. And then the question is, if you could do that for the larger metropolitan areas, what do you do for the smaller communities? What do you do for farmsteads? How do you balance all that? And when we're looking at it, we're saying, how do we learn to live where we are, assuming that we're not going to move everybody out of that 10 miles away, you know, to get out of the floodplain? So you just have to live with the choice that were made before. Do the best you can. Try to manage non-structurally where you can and structurally where you need to. And try to get some answers in place that make sense so we can live there and be resilient with floods, realizing they're going to come, but let's get it so the damages don't keep hitting us, and let's get it where we can afford to get there. That's what we're trying to show you. What we're hoping to lay that out for you next year to show you where we might be able to do that and how long it would take.
And Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Yohi. Does the commission or could the commission track some of the drainage activity that occurs among the member watershed districts? For example, new tiling, any new ditching, any actions that require approval by the member components where, you know, we're talking about a huge public investment here. And is there or could there be some way of tracking these continued, if there are continued activities or new activities, which are removing water from the land faster? I was looking through the public comments, and I see a wide variety of things coming from the public relating to drainage, which is more of a policy question. What I'm asking is on a transparency, just tracking what's going on out there in the basin right now. Are you doing that, or could you do that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, yes, that's possible. We are not doing that. Well, we are developing our GIS database for the areas that we're interested in following. Drainage is one of those, but so is flood damage reduction, water quality, fish and wildlife conservation. We have 13 basin goals that we're working on. 9 are resource-based. Right now, the Red River Watershed Management Board, John Finney's chair of that, is a counterpart in North Dakota, and the North Dakota Joint Water Resource Board, Jim Lyons. Their boards are working on that, and we're going to let them take the lead because they're in a better position to do that than we are. And the lead that they're going to take is looking at that and trying to get at some of those questions. Everybody says drainage is just making it worse on us. We need to ask the question, does it really do that? What does it really do? What does that timing change really mean to us as water moves into the system? I think the way they've been operating on drainage in the past is it's a management tool to protect cropland in the summertime primarily, to protect against a quick rain in a 24-hour period up to, what, 2 or 3, 4 inches to get it off the land so the crops don't get lost. And for us, that's huge. The economic impact of crops in our area is important to our area and to the state. So we need that. The question is, what impact does it have on flooding? How do we tie it in to that as we manage and look ahead? And that's questions we're hoping they can help us understand so we can weave it in. Whether we get in this report or make reference to it that it's coming, I'm not sure where we'll be with that. It's easy to track what's out there. I mean, it's just you can see them on the maps. You can do that. And there's a constant, a steady process of keeping those managing and working the way they're intended to do. But it is a policy issue, you're right.
Representative Hansen.
And just to follow up, I think for those of us who aren't in the basin, when we have constituents who would pay the taxes that would pay for the public investment, having the transparency to see what the policies are, we have great sympathy, and people volunteer and go and want to help on the flooding. But the long term, you know, what we're talking about here are dozens of years of commitment, millions of dollars of public money that would go in, that comes from all of our taxpayers.
So what things are being done on the policy side when our taxpayers see that there's action being taken on the private side, then I think there's more of a willingness for the public investment on the large scale. If we continue to fund publicly the impoundments, the wetland restoration, the levees, and the dikes, but on the other hand, there's still accelerated water removal, you go one step forward, two steps back. And so I think just a minimum of having that data, and we've done this, we're starting to do this with just the buffer side of it, of requiring reporting, but having your member communities, and I realize that not every watershed does have a watershed district in there, so you've got a county role and a myriad of jurisdictions, but having the data helps provide, I think, to taxpayers around the state that there's a whole picture here going on rather than just year after year putting in tens of millions of dollars.
Mr. Yohe.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson. We'll put that in the mix and talk to some folks about it. Now, let me paint up another picture for you, though. It's real easy to look in from the outside and say, okay, you're draining your land, you're getting flooded, so why don't you quit draining? It doesn't quite work as simple as that. It's not as black and white as that. The largest flood we know of is 1826. That's the largest flood of record. Drainage did not start in the Red River Basin until the 1880s. So the largest flood of record was before there was any farming going on, any land drained or anything. So the geography of the reality is we live in the bottom of a lake bed that's very, very flat for a long ways north-south and quite a ways east-west. And it's just going to fill up sometimes. And the real hope that we could have on this whole wetland issue is can wetlands help us on this bounce issue that they talked about? Knowing that you can use wetlands to hold water and get the wetland benefits itself, but if they're full, they're full. I mean, they don't hold anything. They just run off, and they run off faster than anything else because they're all froze over. So that's the issue that people need to try to understand better. It's just, if we went backwards and just stopped all drainage today, it wouldn't take away our flooding. The Corps report that's coming out for the Fargo Moorhead area is already saying that the trend is, looking at that graph, part of that's related to more moisture, a wet cycle, and that's why Devil's Lake is filling up because of excessive rain. And they've also done drainage up there. So, I mean, it's a combination. I'm not saying it's not. It's all of that together, and trying to get your arms around it and understand it is important. And it is a policy issue.
Yeah. Thanks. And Representative Sterner?
Just a quick comment. It seemed like you ruled out that moving the people was not an option, and it just seems like that might be, in some cases, a loss mitigation possibility in certain areas if you look at the cost-benefit analysis and areas. So I would just, you know, consider that as an option, you know, for certain areas.
Okay. And Mr. Yohe.
Mr. Chairman, you're right. It is. And buyouts are going on right now from the 2009 fund to get people out of harm's way. What I meant was just moving 200,000 people. That's what I meant, okay, in a broad statement. Yeah.
And maybe just one last question before we move on to the Army Corps. I was wondering about the water storage issue, and Mr. Anderson, you brought it up too, about water storage is one of the benefits of retention, and for the dry periods, because we will be going into dry periods in the future, and Fargo-Moorhead is going to be experiencing difficulty in having enough water. There's been talk about, you know, piping water in during those dry periods. How much of a benefit would water retention projects of the sort proposing would have for storage purposes for those dry periods?
Mr. Chairman, if you built gated structures, I guess you would have flexibility on holding water longer for the drier summer months. If you build them like a dry dam where it runs over the spillway and then through a culvert, they'll just automatically drain down as it takes time to do that. But it still takes a while to move that stuff through. The worst month for us usually for water supply is about February mm-hmm. because of the ice and the low flows by that time, historically.
Okay, thank you. And I think we'll move on next to the Army Corps. So, and Mr. Craig Evans, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad to be here. My name is Craig Evans. I'm a project manager and planner with the St. Paul District Army Corps of Engineers. Can I proceed?
Sure, proceed.
Okay, today I'm going to present on what the study goals and status were for the Fargo-Moorhead Metro Feasibility Study, talk about the alternatives that we've looked at, the final array of plans that we're still considering, mention the Minnesota cost share or potential for what Minnesota's cost share could be, talk a little about the downstream impacts and about the local decisions that we still need folks to make. The goals that we started with this Fargo-Moorhead Metro Feasibility Study were to develop a system to reduce the flood risk in the region of Fargo and Moorhead. We did not want to just build levees piecemeal here and there. The way things have been done in the past, we recognized that a larger solution was needed. And the second major goal was to determine what the federal role would be in implementing such a system. Going into it, we did not know whether we would find anything the federal government could support. Then the third and fourth ones were to document our findings in a feasibility report and eventually recommend a project to Congress if we found one we could justify. We started the study in September of 2008, before the 2009 flood. Of course, the 2009 flood kind of lit a fire under things, and we've been moving very fast since then. Just this last January, we completed our final screening of alternatives. We're in the process of drafting our report that will go out for review next week within the Corps of Engineers. And because we have not been through that review step, all of our results that we're presenting to date, everything we've presented to the public so far is preliminary. We would not normally have released any of that stuff, but because of the intense interest and the need for people to make decisions, we have been releasing information really much sooner than we would ordinarily, because we want to make sure that it's correct. And at this point, everything is preliminary. We're letting folks know that it could change during review. We have asked the local sponsors to identify by the middle of April whether they like the plans that we're coming up with as a federal plan, and I'll get into some of that later, or if they prefer a local plan that's different than that. And we need to know by mid-April in order for us to meet our schedules. In May, we plan to have a draft report that we can release to the public and get public and agency comments to finalize the report. Our schedule is to have a recommendation to Congress by December of this year. We have looked at a wide range of alternatives, including doing nothing. The no-action alternative is the base that we compare everything else to. We've looked at non-structural measures, relocating the homes out of Fargo and Moorhead. We've looked at diversion channels. We've looked at levees and flood walls. And we have considered flood storage. And of all of those alternatives that we've looked at, in order to achieve the goals that folks have in Fargo and Moorhead, we have determined that diversion channels are the best concept to pursue. They are the most cost-effective way to reduce flood damages in the Fargo-Moorhead metro region. We have two conceptual alignments that we've been looking at. One is in North Dakota. This one is longer, about 11 miles longer than the Minnesota one. But the main feature to point out here is that we cross five rivers with the North Dakota alignment. And I did bring maps that could be passed out that show the two different alignments, so you can have those to look at in a little more detail. But the main point for most of the environmental impacts and other concerns that we have with the North Dakota plan, including cost, is the fact that it crosses these five tributaries to the Red River. The Minnesota plan is shorter, much more simple conceptually. It does not cross any other rivers. It just takes water off of the Red River, routes it around to the east of Moorhead and Dilworth, and brings it back to the Red River down by about where the Cheyenne River comes in now. One important concept from the federal perspective is to identify what we call the National Economic Development Plan, and that is the plan that maximizes the net benefits to the nation. And this chart, the blue line on the chart is the difference between the costs and the benefits of each plan. The smallest plan is on the left side and moving progressively larger. You can see that the smallest plan we looked at gives us the best net benefits. And so that is identified as the National Economic Development Plan, and that plan ordinarily caps the federal cost share. We can pay 65% of what that NED plan is, and if there is a plan other than that plan that the local sponsors want, within certain constraints, we can recommend that larger plan, but the local sponsors have to pay the difference in the cost, 100% of the difference, to get the larger plan. These are the array of plans that are in our final set of things we've looked at. The costs range from about $870 million to $1.3 billion total cost. The local share would be less than that, starting at about $300 million and up to about $730 million. And those numbers for the local share do factor in the fact that the federal share is capped at the smallest plan. The feasibility study is being shared 50-50 between the federal government and the non-federal government, and that total cost of the study is about $8 million. The construction would be cost shared 65% federal and 35% non-federal. And from the Corps perspective, it does not matter to us where the non-federal money comes from as long as it's not federal. So we wouldn't want EPA money or Fish and Wildlife Service money or any other federal contributions. As long as the money comes from state and local coffers, that's fine. And somehow between all of the partners to this project, the non-federal partners have to come up with 35%. But how that share is distributed between the non-federal partners is up to the non-federal partners. It needs to be negotiated locally. So they have to reach consensus on that. And I know there's interest here in how much would the Minnesota share be. And because that's going to be part of the local decision-making, I can't say. But I can tell you one possible approach that they have been considering is sharing it based on the percentage of national economic development benefits that would accrue to each site. And so looking at it that way, which again is not the only way this could be divvied up, we know that less than 10% of the national economic benefits are accruing to Minnesota. Most of the benefits are to structures and infrastructure in the North Dakota side. So if you assume that then 10% of the non-federal share would be Minnesota's share, that would range from $30 million to $73 million. So I think it's fairly safe to say that the Minnesota share will be somewhere in that range, but again, that's up to what the locals decide is a fair share. The downstream stage increases, I know you're aware of and have been already mentioned today. We're estimating right now, with the modeling that we've done, that increases would vary from about 3.6 inches to 10.4 inches for a 100-year flood or a 1% chance event. And that depends on where you are, and it depends on various assumptions that go into the model. So that's why we're presenting a range. We know that the effects go beyond Halstead, Minnesota, but our models at the current time stop at Halstead. So we will be refining and extending the models so that we can identify exactly where that impact ceases and just exactly what the magnitude of the increases are. But again, we're fairly certain it's less than a foot, and we'll be refining the models to see. Compensation for that impact is another concern that we've heard in our public meetings last week. It came up several times. And when we look at this from the federal perspective, deciding whether there is going to be a real estate taking is important, because we can't mitigate, we can't spend federal dollars unless there is a damage, an actual damage we can quantify that we can mitigate for. And that will depend on the frequency of the flooding, how we're changing it, the depth of flooding, the duration, and what expected damages there would be. So, for instance, if you have a farm field that's already in the 100-year flood, it already has 3 feet of water on it, what is the effect of adding another 6 inches to that? We have to get our arms around what is really the damage, and is that something the federal government should spend money to mitigate? At this point in time, our legal staff is looking at this, and they do not feel that there will be a taking, but we're still considering that because we're still modeling what the impacts are, and we need to take some case-by-case looks at specific structures to see if the increase would go from a basement level to a first floor level or things like that. So some of that will be determined case by case, but right now it's not appearing that there will be a taking from the federal perspective. And we also note that Georgetown, Purley, and Hendrum are all planning levee projects. They have been planning those, and when we look at the future without project condition, we would assume that those projects may very likely be in place, which would help to mitigate these effects. And we are working with those three communities through the Red River Basin Watershed Study to help them with technical information and technical assistance. Halstead already has a 250-year levee in place, so these impacts would not, at the 100-year level, would not affect Halstead. This is a map showing what the downstream effects would be, and I think the most obvious thing is that most of the red, which would be the additional impact, is in North Dakota. There's a very thin area of red, which again indicates the difference between what the blue is, what would already be flooded in a 100-year event. The red is additional flooding you would get because of these inches of increased stage. The lay of the land is such in Minnesota that it's more steep, and so there is less of an expansion of the floodplain.
Okay. There is a question, Representative Wagenius.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since this is the first time I've heard from the federal government on this, I have a basic question. It appears to me you're planning for a 100-year flood. Is that correct?
Sure. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, we are planning for all floods, but we have to present the information, and the most frame of reference that's familiar to people is the 100-year flood. So it would have effects at any flood, but it's a range of effects, and how to explain that would be more time-consuming.
Okay. If I could follow up.
And Representative Wagenius.
When you're... the 100-year marker, when was the math done to say what a 100-year flood would be for this area? Was it done a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we are currently revising that calculation. That's one of the things that our hydrologists do. And the work that we're presenting now includes all the floods that we have on record up through the 2009 event. We're also in the process of, we convened a panel of hydrologic experts to help us figure out why flows seem to be increasing. And Mr. Yohe mentioned the dry periods and wet periods. And so we have information that things may be even wetter than the records we have would indicate. And so we're trying to factor that into our calculations, which would even make the 100-year event even larger than what we're currently estimating. So that is a moving target. It's current information that we're using.
Okay, so when will we know, when will you have better information about what that marker is? I understand that you're planning for all floods, but that's a marker that's used and talked about. So when will you have current information? When will you have updated that?
Mr. Evans.
In May, when our draft report goes to the public, we will have updated information that should reflect all of the things we're aware of through the 2009 event. But that will be, it'll continue to be a moving target. Every year that we get a major flood, folks will want to go back and recalculate all of that. It's all a probabilistic assessment, and we work with all the available data that we have.
Our university is spending a lot of time looking at the climate change and the effects on Minnesota and the effects of weather events. Are you taking that work into consideration as you're pegging this number?
Mr. Evans.
We convened a panel of federal agency experts, and I think they, to the extent that they were aware of that information, they're factoring it in. But I don't know the specifics of whether they looked at a Minnesota study or not.
It would be...
Representative Wagenius.
Yes, thank you. It would be helpful if we know what the target is here and how much we can rely on that target because of the information. Do we have all the information that's current to make that target? Okay. So, and if we have the climate change information from places like the University of Minnesota, it's spending a lot of time on this.
Thank you. I'll look into that.
Okay. Yeah,
that would be helpful. So thank you. And please proceed, and do probably try to hold questions, any further questions, until you're done with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This, I believe, is my last slide. But these are the decisions that we asked the local sponsors to consider. What level of risk was tolerable to them? Because, as I mentioned, the National Economic Development Plan, from the federal perspective, sets the cost sharing, but it does not tie the local sponsors into a certain level of protection. And that plan, being the smallest that we looked at, probably does not meet the goals of the local sponsors. And so we understand that they may be wanting a larger plan, and we may be willing or able to support that. But that was one of the key questions we had for them, because it is up to them. How much do they want to pay, and how much protection are they willing to live with? So that leads to the locally preferred options that we need them to tell us. What do they want us to keep looking at? They need to develop a consensus on what that plan is, because no one in your shoes will want to support it unless there's a local consensus on what to do. We need their written response by April 15th in order to meet our schedules. We also need them to identify who is going to be the sponsor for the construction and ongoing operation and maintenance. And one of the points that was discussed here earlier is who pushes the button, who controls what happens during a flood. Well, that would be, in this case, whoever that local sponsor is for the project. They will be the ones operating it and maintaining it during floods. And then defining the non-federal cost-sharing arrangements amongst the partners is another local decision that still needs to be made. Our contact information is here, and that website has got all of the information that we've made publicly available, so you can feel free to go there and get any maps or handouts or anything that we've provided to the public. That's all available there. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Evans. And I have questions pertaining to the downstream impact. And I know you're looking at the diversion alone as far as the federal government's involvement here. But I was made aware of it, that there's an executive order that was made going back to 1977 that I believe is still in effect, dealing with downstream impacts of diversion projects and other flood projects. It was ordered by President Carter, and it states that the federal agencies should avoid actions located in or adversely affecting floodplains unless there is no practicable alternative. It seems to me that retention is a practical alternative. We've been hearing testimony on that tonight, and I think, you know, talking about the cost of it, it is something that is cost-effective, especially when you consider all of the benefits that go along with it. And it also says in the executive action that these agencies are to take action to mitigate losses if avoidance is not practicable. And I was just wondering if, does the Army Corps of Engineers adhere to this order? It was Executive Order 11988. You're familiar with that?
Yes.
Would you respond to your actions in regard to this order?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that executive order is primarily to keep federal agencies, it applies to all federal agencies, to keep us from spending federal dollars to take land out of the floodplain. It's not intended to say that we can't have effects on floodplains, but we are supposed to be careful, especially when we're doing projects like levee systems and diversions that would take land out of the floodplain that isn't currently developed. Because the executive order mentions that those areas have value as they are as natural floodplains. And that is a consideration we've looked at. We've tried with the diversion alignments to minimize the amount of wetland that wetlands too, but the amount of floodplain that we're taking out, because the more floodplain we take out, the larger impacts we will have downstream. But the executive order does not keep us from proposing these things. In terms of what is a practicable alternative, what Mr. Anderson and Mr. Yohe presented earlier was that if you built practically all of the storage we think you could find upstream of Fargo and Moorhead, you could have maybe a 2-foot stage reduction in town. A 2-foot stage reduction for a 100-year event. For events larger than a 100-year event would be a catastrophic event, a 500-year event or something like that. Storage will have even less effect. And so the kind of stage reductions that we're able to achieve with the diversion are up to 9 feet for a 100-year event and probably on the order of 6 feet for a 500-year event. We are providing the communities of Fargo-Moorhead and that area, even during a 500-year flood, a situation that they could handle. Even the smallest diversion we've looked at would take a 500-year event and make it comparable to what they just survived in 2009. There is no way that storage will be able to accomplish that. And that's why folks are talking about storage as a supplement to these other things. Right.
And Mr. Evans, that's what I'm speaking about, as a supplement. And that means, you know, for the downstream impact. Nobody's suggesting that there's not going to be a diversion. The question is there going to be anything else in addition to the diversion? And should we be considering the impact on those who are living downstream or not? And I think that, you know, obviously there is a practical solution for those that are downstream in mitigating for the downstream impact. And as far as the downstream impact is concerned, I know that calculations have been made that it's probably going to be under a foot for a 100-year event. Questions have already been raised about what constitutes a 100-year event and that is under revision right now. And as far as projections are concerned, it seems that sometimes the projections are not correct. I was wondering if there's any information that you could provide as far as what other diversions have shown to be the case in an actual downstream impacts, like, for instance, the diversion around Grand Forks. Do you have information as far as how that impacted Oslo, for instance, which was further downstream, and whether the increase in the downstream impact due to that flood was higher than projected, or was it what was projected for this most recent flood? Because we know that Oslo was surrounded and inundated by water for many weeks. So I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't have any of that information with me. I'm sure that it could be developed if we wanted to take the time to build the models. The modeling is increasing in sophistication every year, and so we're able to do incredible things today that we couldn't have done 5 years ago. The other thing to keep in mind is that each geographic location is different, and each project is different. There are so many variables that it really is not that useful to compare something in Grand Forks to something in Fargo to something in Breckenridge, because they're all unique. I think the accuracy of the model is something you could maybe compare and say, you know, we thought it would be this, but it actually turned out something else. But again, when we're modeling, we're dealing with theoretical events. We're trying to match the model to known events so that it reacts the way nature did during that specific event. But when you're projecting in the future, there are too many variables to know for sure how the situation will react. To compare a modeled event to an actual event in the future is very difficult.
And I guess that's one of the concerns that I have, that it is possible that the flood events could far exceed what the projections have so far determined as far as downstream impact. And so I do have concerns about that. And again, I think that we need to be looking at the whole picture here and not just Fargo-Moorhead, which is important, but we also need to be looking at the whole region and how it's going to be affecting all the towns of the area. And have a more holistic, comprehensive approach to flood control. And I don't know if anyone else have questions. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, I want to thank you and the members for devoting a very significant amount of time to address these very difficult and complex issues. We're talking about huge investments that are going to need to be made going forward here, and so I think it deserves that kind of time and attention you're giving it. I just wanted to make a couple of points with regard to the core project. First of all, Mr. Chairman, I totally agree with the concern about the impact on the downstream, and that's why I advocated this funding for the Basin Commission to do the kind of analysis that they've talked about here today and to be about the business of trying to figure out how can we mitigate any potential downstream impacts that there are. So, and I know my colleagues back in Moorhead and Clay County share that concern. We want that problem solved. We're going to need some kind of a diversion. There's no question about that. But we also need retention, impoundments, wherever we can to mitigate any potential downstream impacts. So I want everybody to know that that's our commitment as well. The feeling on the part of people in our area is that there are two diversion options here, or two main options, North Dakota, Minnesota. The preference clearly is for this to be on the North Dakota side. Most of the benefit, as you've heard, will go to North Dakota. 90% or more of the benefit of this project will accrue to North Dakota. So it makes only the most sense to put this in North Dakota. You're also in North Dakota going to be protecting more property. It's more difficult because you do cross five tributaries, so it's more costly as a result. But the clear preference on the part of people and our part of Minnesota is that it needs to be in North Dakota. And increasingly, that's the consensus also on the North Dakota side, that it should be in North Dakota. I want to point out something else with regard to the local option or the local costs. If we have to come up with 10% in Minnesota, I think you need to be aware that any bonding dollars that go to that can't be spent in North Dakota. And so if we have North Dakota diversion, Minnesota bonding dollars could only go to the structure on the main stem that would be on the Minnesota half of the river. So that control structure, maybe Mr. Evans could say how much they would estimate the control structure on the main stem would cost, and it's only half of that that Minnesota could use bonding dollars to fund. But Minnesota bonding dollars couldn't be spent on any of the diversion channel on the North Dakota side. So I think I wanted everybody to be aware of that. And maybe Mr. Evans could address that question about that control structure.
Sure. And Mr. Evans.
Yeah. Currently, the estimate we have for all of the features in Minnesota, which would include the control structure and the tieback levee, is roughly $50 million. So they're a very small percentage of the total North Dakota plan would be built on Minnesota soil.
Sure. Are there any other questions for Mr. Evans? Okay, seeing none, thank you. Thank you for coming, Mr. Evans.
Thank you.
And we have a couple more. Next, I would like to invite down the mayor of Hendrum, Mayor Kurt Johansson, and also Ms. Diane Ista, if you would like to come forward as well from the Wild Rice Watershed. Welcome, Mayor, and welcome, Ms. Ista. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Diane Ista. I'm going to add I'm a farmer by profession. I'm a Wild Rice Watershed, Minnesota Watershed District Manager, and I'm also a member of the Red River Water Management Board. Thank you very much for this hearing and for bringing the concerns forward to your committee. We just greatly appreciate it. When dikes were built around the small cities of Purley and Hendrum on the Red River of the North, they were mainly built to protect from the east because of the south branch of the Wild Rice River. And with the increase in floodwaters on the Red River, they had a very unpleasant surprise. They're now fighting the floodwaters from the west side also, for which they did not have adequate protection. The Wild Rice Watershed District requested funding from the Minnesota Legislature to assist the cities to raise and improve their dikes. The distribution of this funding is administered by the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources to use where they felt it would be the most needed. We have very fortunately felt from them it has been a priority. The Wild Rice Watershed District called the director of the DNR Water Division to relate the serious flooding damage to the small towns of Purley, Hendrum, Halsted, Shelley, Ada, Borup, and Felton in the Wild Rice Watershed District were suffering with the 2009 flood. This had a traumatic effect on these small towns as they fought these floodwaters. I'm going to add, I heard the mayor tell about the one night he thought he could get to bed. All of a sudden they had a crack in the dike about this wide, so that went his sleep for that night too. The Division of Waters of the DNR allocated $7 million for the purpose of raising and building dikes to protect these cities. The watershed began meeting with individual city councils to hear what their needs were and asked if they would like assistance to raise the dikes for their cities. There was a lot of interest and appreciation for the help. Preliminary engineering was done and the watershed met with the cities again. The cities of Purley and Hendrum have signed petitions for the dike improvements and the soil boring and land acquisition and so on is underway. And thank you, the funding has also followed. The city of Borup did not feel they needed a dike at this time, and the city of Felton just recently signed their petition for a dike, so that process will begin there. The city of Shelley has severe flooding, and the Wild Rice Watershed District will be meeting with the city of Shelley on February 15th for another community meeting where a decision will soon follow. The city of Ada was working with the Corps on a 205 study to build a certified dike around Ada. That started in about 1998. Yeah, in October 2009, they received the word that the cost of the project had doubled from $8 million to $16 million, and the city of Ada was told there could be possibly a two-year delay because of the huge Fargo-Moorhead core diversion study. The city of Ada is now working to acquire funding from Minnesota legislature through the DNR to build a certified dike. And we appreciate those efforts. The year of 2009 was flooding in the spring planting, late fall harvest, much of it still standing in the fields, which caused a lot of scheduling problems for the cities to be able to move forward as quickly as they would have liked in getting these dikes underway. When the cities of Fargo-Moorhead began putting their flood protection plan together and the cities downstream of Fargo-Moorhead realized they were studying diversion proposals which could change the downstream flow regime to these small cities, residents and landowners along the Red River had a tremendous feeling of apprehension. Through pressure and pleas from the landowners and the cities and the landowners, the residents around the watershed district, our Wild Rice Watershed District, passed a resolution forming the Red River Downstream Impact Work Group, requesting of the Metro Flood Study Work Group and Committee, which is what I believe the technical name is for this diversion study out of Fargo-Moorhead, that the impacts that would affect all of those downstream be on the top of their agenda, with a request for a commitment from the diversion group to assure us that there will be zero downstream impacts and that our downstream group would be included in the discussions of the Metro Flood Study Work Group and Committee. A meeting was held of the downstream group to form the initial core. This was made up of mayors from the affected cities along the Red River, county commissioners, residents that lived along the Red River, and a letter was sent to all the township, counties, cities, and so on along the Red River to invite them to be a part of this group. At the present time, we have members from Cragness to the Canadian border. At the last Metro Flood Study Work Group meeting at the Fargo City Hall on February 14th, we were informed from the Corps, as Mr. Evans stated, that for the diversion study, that the Minnesota diversion may increase the floodwaters. I heard 6 to 8 inches, where these are very variable, and a diversion on the North Dakota side could cause an increase in downstream impacts up to 10.4 or whatever. This is a very strong reason for concern. We are aware until the Fargo-Moorhead area make their decision whether the diversion is going to be on the Minnesota side or the North Dakota side, we were just going to consider ourselves a watchdog group. After the decision is made on which diversion that will be built, the Metro Flood Work Group will be conducting a study. They have authorized hiring engineers to do a downstream impact study and an upstream impact study, as well as if it's the Minnesota diversion, to protect those in the North Fargo area that would not be protected. And we greatly appreciate that. We were very, very pleased to hear that, because we feel we're in very much in need of it. We are anxious to hear the status of the progress of retention products that may be feasible south of Fargo, and also if there will be any funding assistance or support for flood retention downstream, such as in the watershed district, on tributaries in the Red River, so that we can start mitigating some of these impacts. We are concerned and know the Fargo-Moorhead area needs protection from the very serious flooding problems they are going through. And we need the Corps and the Metro Flood Study Work Group and Committee to respect the concerns of those downstream and to find a solution to their flood issues with zero impacts from the diversion. We feel that, I hear that we throw out, well, we think that what we are doing to raise the dikes for Hendrum and Purley and the ones in our watershed district are going to be adequate. what happened when the 2009 flood, they had built it up this high, and they still were getting very close to the top. So obviously, a 10-inch impact, 6-inch impact, would not be adequate to meet more impacts downstream. So there's a lot of concern. We are very grateful for the dikes that are being built, but what I would like to state is very much like what Representative Saylor was talking about, the fact that we have so many damages, and you're putting money into Band-Aids and into protecting and having people sit within a ring dike for 6 weeks, and our economy, the business, the Pearly gas station, I believe they lost $40,000 in that time. I don't think any small community business can afford to lose money like that and keep in business. So I know you all know how very serious it is to our impacts. But the only thing that's going to resolve that is that we can keep our state highways open, that we can keep we can have some type of an infrastructure that's going to be still continuing on. And of course, I'm extremely concerned about the ag community. When they say the impacts, when I can show you pictures of erosion in those fields that can be 3 to 5 feet deep, and there is no way they're going to repair those and be able to farm that land in that year. So there is a lot of farmers, and as a manager, we're not in favor of increasing any size of culverts. We only go for smaller culverts, and you would be surprised how many farmers who have water standing in their fields from 3 to 5 days have crop damage, but they don't ask for a bigger culvert because they feel they're part of the process to hold that water and to be in voluntary or involuntary storage. So I think we are all working together. And it's a huge responsibility for you as the legislature for the funding of all of this. And I want to add one more thing. You ask about what the federal government has done. Congressman Peterson and Senator Klobuchar brought in the NRCS chief, Dave White, in May. And through that, they have been financing the farmstead ring dikes, which has been major bringing to us. And he also toured our watershed district to look at all of our projects, including Upper Becker, our South Branch, and whatever, as to where they thought their criteria would fit in so they could do some conservation programs, a part of our storage and retention areas. And we will be meeting with them March 2nd again, and we're hoping that we're trying all we can to bring some funding in also from the federal level, and obviously we need more, but we do have good support there, and I'm sure as we move ahead we will hear that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Ista. And Mayor Johansson, welcome to the committee.
Good evening. My name is Kurt Johansson, Mayor of Hendrum. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to address the committee this evening. Just to give you an idea, I guess, I wonder if some of you don't exactly know where Hendrum is. You've probably heard many things, but Hendrum is about 28 miles north of Fargo-Moorhead on Highway 75. It sits in this little triangle with the Red River a mile to its west, and the Wild Rice River a half mile to its east. So when a major flood comes along, we get it from both sides. Hendrum has a major problem like any other communities do along the Red River Valley, and that's just what to do with the water. After the 1997 flood, they built a rain dike around town, and they built it 2 feet higher than what the maximum levels of the 97 flood were. At that time, they felt that was adequate. And it was for 12 years until the 2009 flood came along. And unfortunately, there was many things that we can't predict. Of course, we had higher record levels than we did in 97. But we had several ice jams. In fact, I believe there were 7 ice jams downstream from Hendrum that caused the water to back up significantly, really fast. And it came within inches of going over our levee system. Through extreme sandbagging efforts, we were able to save the town. It was right then, once we were mentally and physically exhausted, we vowed that we must find more flood protection for our community. through the help of the Wild Rice Watershed District, we have found a plan that we'd be raising our levee system, our rain dike, approximately 3 feet higher than what the maximum 09 flood levels were. That is if we get the funding. We need this funding now more than ever because of the proposed Fargo-Moorhead diversion. The proposed Fargo-Moorhead diversion would dump approximately 10.4 more inches of water on the Hendrum area in a maximum flood event. We cannot handle this much more water. It is unacceptable. It would be catastrophic not only for a town of our size, but every town along the Red River Valley. Because this is not just affecting us, but everybody downstream from Fargo-Moorhead all the way to Lake Winnipeg. I strongly believe, and I understand, that Fargo-Moorhead needs their flood protection. But if we work together, why can't we find a solution that's going to benefit this whole valley instead of just one localized area? And I know it's not just going to take a series of one events that's going to do it. It's going to take several things. It'll probably will continue to have our rain dikes, and it might take a possible diversion. But retention. Retention is the key here. Retention. Holding the water back at its source, I believe, is the key. Because we can keep building these rain dikes. We can keep building them until we can't see the sunset anymore. We can probably keep ourselves dry, but sort of what Diane commented on here, what happens when a major flood event like this, fortunately the flood events we've had so far, we've still been able to have access outside of our community. But 10.4 more additional inches onto the maximum flood level would turn us into an island. And that means we would be locked in there for a period of 6 weeks to 2 months. It takes that long for the water to flow away. And when I refer to the Hendrum community, I don't refer to it just as what's inside the city limits. In an agricultural community, Hendrum community consists of everybody in the area, the farmers that live outside of town and everybody. So we band together, and if we're isolated off inside town and every individual farm is isolated off, what are we supposed to do in a state of an emergency? What if someone has a heart attack out in the country? We can never get to them. They're on their own. What if their house would start on fire? There's no way, because the services inside the city limits of Hendrum cannot get out to the people needed in the country because we're totally surrounded by water. In addition, retention would help the runoff issue. Like everyone said, agriculture is a major key of our area. It's no doubt that the Red River Valley is probably the most productive agricultural land in the world. And every time it floods, it is washing away more and more down the river. And it's creating a huge problem for Lake Winnipeg. When the water washes off the soils, it brings along residue, like fertilizer residue, and washes it down the river, and mineral deposits, and et cetera. And it all ends up in Lake Winnipeg. And now, because of it, Lake Winnipeg has a huge algae problem. So what I'm getting here at is this retention is not only going to help Fargo-Moorhead, Hendrum, Halsted, but everybody down the river, and even all the way to Lake Winnipeg. There is more to this than just one localized area. I've said this before, I'm so proud to be from the Midwestern area because this is an area that people, their neighbors, they go out and help one another in a time of need. During these flood events, I believe that's why we've been so successful, because we may not know our neighbor's last name, but we know they're in trouble and we go out there and help them. And I strongly believe that's why we've been beating all these floods. And I believe if we put that same mentality into finding a solution for the entire Red River Valley, we can come about it. Passing on the buck, so to speak, isn't acceptable. Considering a smaller community, collateral damage for the bigger good isn't acceptable. We all have a right to live here in the valley, and we all have a right to live here in harmony. And I just, let's bring together our neighborly, our community spirit. And I know we can do this. Let's get it done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Are there any questions? I would like to thank you very much for coming and your testimony here today. And I do think in Minnesota we've had a great tradition of being good neighbors to each other. And I'm hopeful that in the future we will come up with a comprehensive flood plan that will include everyone. Including those that are downstream from the major population centers in our state. So thank you again for coming. I appreciate all you've done. I understand, Mayor, that you took over just months before the flood came. So that was a real trying experience, I'm sure, just learning the ropes. And you did an outstanding job in working for your city, And thank you, Ms. Ista, also for all that you've been doing. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee.
Thank you for having us.
And we do have Mr. Bentz. No, you want to just pass, or did you? Okay. Mr. Bench.
Thank you, Welcome. Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief. The hour is getting late. I've got a good friend, old Bob Lassard, who is meeting me for a beer afterwards, but this is an important issue. This is an extremely important issue. I respectably disagree with some of the assessments that have been made, but I'll concentrate on the agreements first. The upwater retention. Let me give a little background on where I'm coming from. My name is Les Bench. I was born and raised in the Tinta Wendell area, right in the lowest point of the Lake Agassiz lake bed. When I was 6 years old, that was about 60-some years ago, I sat out on my uncle's D6 cat as we were digging the trench to drain the wetlands to put into the ditch that drained to Tinta that eventually made it down to the Red River. So I was part of that problem area in the start of it, and now I'm sitting on a little different side of the fence. I sit on the other side of the Continental Divide over in Otter Tail County. I am a member of the Lassard Outdoor Heritage Council. I do not speak for the council right now. I speak as Citizen Bench. That's what my opinion is. As a very concerned citizen as to how we are going to ecologically and environmentally balance this problem and the situation and how we can best affect it. Our interests are primarily going to be aimed at steering as much funding as we possibly can. Over the next 23 years, we're 2 years into the cycle, we're going to be putting in, if we just look at geological distribution of the funds, about $500 million into this area, this geological area. I think we can make a big impact in solving a lot of problems. And our primary emphasis is going to be wetlands, restoration. Some of the plans we're going to be working with is the duck recovery plan, the strategic habitat conservation plan that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has to create the habitat complexes. The diversity that's going to occur in the agricultural field is going to happen. We're going to be out of a cycle of the four crop rotation to possibly looking at diverting to some of the lands into rotational grazing, utilizing that land. The Fergus Falls ethanol plant in Chapter 11 right now is looking at a conversion to the cellulosic fuels at a future point. So looking at a certain diversity of agricultural interest is going to happen. That's a firm. Some of the things that we've observed and seen is just what are we going to be doing with the water that we're running up to Lake Winnipeg, our good neighbors of the North, Canada. What are the damages that we're going to occur with the increased volume, increased sediment runoff? I don't know that we're going to stop the project of the diversion. I don't know that we're going to have any impact on it one way, but we can help solve some of the problems by creating that upland storage for the habitat. We'll look at it as a habitat restoration protection with the floodplain benefit as one of the other major elements, but we're going to be addressing that quite severely. We've talked with the different watershed districts, Bois de Sioux, the Buffalo Red, and looking at the potential 285,000 acre feet of water, I think we have to also look at, what does the wild rice in the Cheyenne have to offer? This is not going to be a unified solution for Minnesota. It has to be Minnesota and North Dakota jointly affecting this. And the headwaters is the main area that we're going to put the emphasis. So I disagree with some of the assessments of the Army Corps of Engineers. I think we've got to look at some of the environmental damages that we're going to create and some of the solutions that we potentially can offer the protection of the population areas of Fargo-Moorhead. But I think we have to put our collective heads together and try to look at this from all aspects. I thank Lance Yoy for the conference that was put on in Grand Forks a couple weeks ago, the Red River Basin Commission. One of the interesting points of this commission was legal talk by Edward Thomas from Massachusetts. Normally, I don't take legal advice with too much of a grain of salt, but this individual hit the nail right on the head. I've asked myself the question over the last 40 or 50 years, why are we allowing this to happen? Why are we continuing the tiling, drainage, and the exacerbation of the problems that we're seeing? Pure and simple, we haven't enforced the law. The law is there. The law has been proven by case precedent in all the states in the Union, every country in the world. It dates back all the way to Roman times. The law of no adverse effect, or the law of, in English, he uses the Latin term, use your property so you do not harm others. A doctrine that basically looks at life and loving relationships between neighbors, solving the problem through an equity between the people that you're living with. As a lawyer, Ed brought up the point that the legal remedies are the last possible remedy that we should pursue. We have to try to solve these problems on a basis of with the people and look at all the aspects of it. And I think with the diversions that we're going to look at, we're not going to address that part of it, but with the retention, the storage, the restoration of the wetlands, the potential waffle patterns helping us in some cases, and also, yes, the reservoirs, because once we hit the dry cycle, the estimate from the Army Corps of Engineers is that Fargo-Moorhead will be about a 45% shortage of water. So there's many, many different aspects of this that we have to look at, and I think we have to take them all into consideration. But the plan that was generated back in 1998 that started the implementation in 1999, if we would have continued on that plan, we would have been well underway as far as solving this problem. I think it's time to pull the trigger. We've analyzed this long enough. We are going to aggressively pursue the retention projects upstream. We are going to progressively aim at that factor of it. And this is only one part of the solution. Hopefully we can modify our diversion project to be ecologically more sound and take care of some of our neighbors to the north and not create additional problems. As Native American philosophy, it's one I think we have to live by. It's measuring our accomplishment by the condition which we leave our environment for our future generations. And personally, I feel that the diversion project is an ecological disaster in the making, and we have to be very careful in the process. The legal challenges that are taking place in this from our good neighbors to the north and from the Moorhead people. I was supposed to be at a meeting up in Moorhead last Monday. Snowstorm prevented that, but they have engaged legal representative from a law firm in the cities, and the legal challenges are going to be heavy, great, and extensive. If we put a shovel in the ground in the next 10 years, I'd be real surprised. So as an alternative, let's take some of the bureaucratic stumbling blocks away from the engineering talent that we have, the solutions that we have, and let's get going on these things. We've waited too long. We've delayed 12 years already. We've got a half a dozen projects that are going. We're going to have to increase that tenfold, a hundredfold to make this thing happen. The funding will be there. The funding is coming. And let's let our engineers and our technical people get the job done. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Bench. Any questions at all? Well, thank you for your testimony. And I agree, as far as the multiple benefits that you would derive from retention, I think one of the problems we sometimes have in the modern era now is that we often look at problems in isolation, and we don't look at the multiple benefits that can be derived from certain projects like retention. Like, for instance, is looking at the flood problem, but not considering the other problems that could be addressed through retention. You're talking about the environmental benefits and the benefits of water storage and the benefits of improved water quality, reduced erosion, all of those problems that can be addressed through retention. I think those also need to be taken into consideration, not just the flood benefits, but also these other benefits that they can also be derived. So Thank you so much for your testimony here today, Mr. Bench.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And one last comment. One of the other high considerations is what is going to happen to the aquifer in the Fargo-Moorhead area once we dig that ditch and once we destroy the certain of the subsurface layers. I think it's a thing that we have to be concerned about, and if it does get destroyed, we're in a major problem area again. So thank you, Council. Thank you, everybody, for your attention.
Thank you. Anyone else want anything to say? Seeing none, thank you very much. Appreciate you staying so late, and the meeting is adjourned.